The $3.6 billion that Bank of America, in essence, gave to the Merrill Lynch employees in bonuses, he says he doesn't know where it went or who gave the authority. So now when they go to the Merrill Lynch CEO, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, he says the same thing. Oh, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. No. Bank of America gave the bonus. And then Bank of America says it wasn't us. Merrill Lynch gave the bonus. So nobody had any authority, but somehow $3.6 billion flew out of the door. The interests of these executives are not the interests of the banks. They don't really give a damn if Merrill Lynch exists.
This week in Radical History for the week starting March 9th.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
And this week in Radical History from March 9th, 1865, showing that the U.S. is just fine with multitasking, U.S. military forces land at Veracruz, Mexico, and Panama, all to protect American interest simultaneously. Also on March 9th, 1879, anarchist Carlos Trotsky lives. Unlike some of the more famous anarchists of their times like Berkman and Goldman, Trotsky was early about being leery of the communist Bolshevik takeover of Russia and fought hard against the fascist rise in Italy, until forced to leave for America. Italy would put pressure on the U.S. to deport Trotsky back, and though the FBI would gather over 1,300 pages of information on Trotsky, he is able to stay ahead of the game until gunned down most likely by a mafia person in 1943. Also on this date in 1892, Ida B. Wells, friend and neighbor Tom Most, is lynched, which would prompt her anti-lynching campaign, which is followed by the destruction of a printing press and her move from Memphis to New York. In response to the alarming increase of lynching of African Americans, she compiled and published in 1895 a statistical study of lynching called A Red Record. Wells Barnett was also an integral part of the early civil rights movement, participating as secretary of the National Afro-American Council that led to the formation of the NAACP. Ida B. Wells.
And on this day in 1945, a fleet of specially modified U.S. bomber planes embarked on a mission to firebomb civilian targets in Tokyo, Japan. The actual bombing began the following day as more than 2,000 tons of incendiary explosives were dropped on houses, shops, and buildings, killing between 80 and 130,000 non-combatant Japanese civilians in the largest firestorm ever recorded. The firebombing of Tokyo was a decisive factor in forcing the Japanese surrender, which was already imminent when the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on the civilian centers of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Historians argue today over whether either act was justified, but many Japanese and Americans alike regard both bombings as crimes against humanity for which the U.S. has never atoned. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 9th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lastly, from March 9th, 1969, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which featured controversial music acts such as The Beatles, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, and blacklisted Pete Seeger, is canceled by CBS Television. This is in the wake of the controversy over the on-air censorship of guest star Joan Baez. CBS Television canceled the show after they let Joan Baez dedicate a song to her husband David, who was convicted of draft resistance against the Vietnam War. This week in Radical History for March 10th.
The Russian Revolution began on this day in 1917, or at least the seminal events that led to the overthrowing of the Russian monarch or czar, when women workers in textile factories in Petrograd walked off their jobs and marched in the streets demanding bread and provisions, which were in short supply on account of the Russian participation in World War I. Socialists, including the Bolshevik Party of one Vladimir Lenin, urged the broadening of the marchers' demands to include an end to the war and the replacement of the monarchy with a democratically elected form of government. Tsar Nicholas responded by ordering his generals to suppress the marches with violence. The marchers, in turn, became more determined and succeeded in ousting the Tsar, whereupon a provisional government was established that represented the Russian aristocracy. And on this day in 1970, the trial of 30 U.S. soldiers responsible for the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War commenced. The massacre, in which an Army battalion systematically raped, butchered, and burned between 300 and 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians under orders from Lieutenant Calley. Of the defendants, only Calley was convicted, himself of killing 22 civilians, a crime for which he served a total of 3 years in prison. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 10th.
This week in radical history, from March 11th, 1833, U.S. invades Nicaragua to protect blank interests. Anyone? Anyone?
Bueller, Bueller, anyone, anyone, Bueller.
On this day, March 11th, in 1917, the British Army conquered the Mesopotamian capital city of Baghdad from the Turks, dealing a decisive blow to the Ottoman Empire. The Turks had ruled over the region with some degree of brutality, and although the British general Sir Frederick Stanley Maude, who commanded the British troops there, proclaimed on this day that the British had arrived, quote, not as conquerors but as liberators, unquote, the preceding period of British colonial rule was even bloodier. Within a few years, several nationalist revolts were suppressed and tens of thousands of citizens were killed. The British even used poison gas against entire villages during that period. In 2001, a group of leaders of the Zapatista Rebellion in southern Mexico arrived at the Zocalo, or Central Square, in Mexico City amid the triumphal cheers of more than 10,000 people, culminating the end of a 15-day march from Chiapas to call attention to the systematic denial of civil rights for the region's indigenous communities by the Mexican government. The Zapatistas had initially begun their rebellion as a protest over the North American Free Trade Agreement, a treaty with the United States, which has had a disastrous impact on Mexico's rural economies. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 12th in 1864, General Carleton, commander of the Department of New Mexico, wrote an insightful letter to a fellow general regarding the recent surrender of the Navajo people. The letter proclaimed, quote, they found it was their destiny, too, as it had been that of tribe after tribe, to give way to the insatiable progress of our race. They threw down their arms and have come to us with confidence in our magnanimity. Talk about a perfect example of white supremacy and sense of entitlement. And they teach us that manifest destiny was a noble concept. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
More bad news on March 12, 1992 in Guatemala. Efren Bamaca, husband of U.S. activist Jennifer Harvey, is seized by the military in the employ of the CIA. He is later tortured and killed. This week in radical history from March 13th, only have two items, 1864. First contingent of 1,430 Navajo reach Fort Sumter, New Mexico, during the Long Walk of the Navajo, a 400-mile forced march in which thousands would die. Also in spring of 1932 in this state, hunger marches take place throughout the country, and bonus marchers are expelled from Washington, D.C. The bonus marchers were World War I vets denied their bonuses for fighting all those years earlier. The current military would rush the encampment of the World War I vets with bayonets and tanks, showing once again how disposable our vets are once they're all used up. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 14th in 1794, Eli Whitney patented the cotton gin. The cotton gin, a machine that quickly separated cotton from the seeds inside, greatly sped up cotton production and increased demand for the plant. As a result, the African slave trade in America, which had been losing popularity, saw a great resurgence and the slave population increased by millions. Although Whitney is given credit for the invention of the cotton gin, there is evidence that the true inventor was actually a slave. Slaves who were not even considered full human beings had no rights to patents. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on March 14, 1912, IWW workers, industrial workers of the world, agree to terms granting wage increases as 10,000 strikers gather and vote, successfully ending the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike. The strike was predicated on wage cuts and horrendous working conditions in Lawrence. Martial law had been declared by the city-owned big business. Workers were arrested, some sent to jail for a year. A young Syrian striker, John Ramey, was bayoneted to death and a pregnant woman beat so badly by police that she gave birth to a dead baby as the strike dragged on. But the workers refused to give in, and when the raises were won, the strikers insisted that the largest increase go to the lowest paid amongst them. This is also the end of this week's This Week in Radical History, which was produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Studios. Thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio for the audio I borrowed and abused. So did you like the shorter version or do you like the longer lengths? Let me know what you think by contacting me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's one long run-on word and address, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Got to run. This may be the end, but as always and forever, I am yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
We'll all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We
slowly learning that fact.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that each week we present it on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Our entire broadcast this morning is our conversation with Boston College professor Eve Spangler, who for the last decade has taught a course on the Israel-Palestine conflict. As part of the course, she takes her students to Israel-Palestine each January. Upon her return just a few weeks ago, she wrote an engaging article for the news service Mondeweiss, and it is the observation she made during this last trip, reflected in this article, that we will discuss this morning. Eve is also an author. Her most recent book is titled Understanding Israel-Palestine: Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict, where she applies human rights standards to the current struggle. A must read. Here is our conversation with Eve Spangler.
Eve, you teach a course at Boston College on the Israel-Palestine struggle. I take it it's a sociology course?
Yes, it is.
And I'd like to begin with our discussion of you describing the course. What are you trying to achieve?
Well, I'm trying to get people not to be afraid of thinking about the conflict, because most people's first reaction is, oh, it's too complicated and they've been killing each other for hundreds of years and how am I ever going to contribute anything useful? This is in the context of BC, which is constantly drumming into students that they should be people for others. So we want them, of course, to come out of school and be able to make a living, but we also want them to make a difference and to want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And in that context, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think, often feels to people like just a bridge too far. So I'm trying to demystify that. And I'm making an argument in the course. It's a seminar we meet once a week. In favor of human rights as the basis for addressing this conflict. It gets you out of the endless he said, she said kind of back and forth. So we start the course by looking at human rights documents. Everybody thinks they're in favor of them, but they haven't actually read the Universal Declaration, the Geneva Conventions, the basic texts. And so we start with a conversation about what those texts actually say, what they require of us, and so forth. Then I have a section that's probably the longest on the history, looking at the conflicting narratives. And then I do a section that I think very few people who teach the conflict do, which is I look at the economics of it, of whether or how it profits Israel to be an occupying power. And, of course, their military industry and their military technology makes the occupation very profitable because it becomes a kind of lab for testing new weapons. And then we look at political conflicts, which is the one-state, two-state debate, which is now shifting very rapidly thanks to President Trump's comments. And then the last section of the course, I let students break themselves up into work groups to pursue interests of their own. So one group typically is about pop culture and how the conflict is portrayed in rap music and spoken word poetry and media like that. One group will be, because strangely I attract a lot of pre-med students, so one is on health, one working group. One working group is on religion and religious narratives. I don't think this is primarily a religious conflict at all, but for people, the question there is for people who are not fanatics or fundamentalists, but who take their religion seriously, what does Islam or Christianity or Judaism require of people? And then the last working group typically is comparative conflict resolution. So how have other long and tractable conflicts ended? So students then report back to the class. So those are our units. And then we go on a trip over winter break of about 10 days, half in Israel, half in Palestine.
And talk about the students.
They're wonderful.
Typically take this. Are they sociology majors, or do you draw right across?
It's a very mixed crowd. Some are sociology majors, and they're likely to have taken other courses with me and to know me. A lot of them are international studies majors, or fewer than I would have expected, Islamic civilization majors. And then I have this cluster of pre-meds. And now, you know, I've taught it for 9 years, so now there's a kind of referral network. Almost everybody who comes has a friend who's done this course and trip before.
How many kids are we talking about?
25 or 26 a year.
Wow, that's a
good-sized group. And, yeah, it's sometimes a little challenging on the trip.
Particularly when you're moving them overseas, right?
Yeah, and moving them overseas. But they're wonderful. They tend to be very good academically. I'm very pleased that I've been found by our AHANA community. That's an acronym. That's sort of communities of color. Mm-hmm. Because I'm very, very interested in promoting the civil rights view of the Palestinian struggle and the ties to the American civil rights movement. So some of that is happening.
So do you get a diverse crowd or diverse
Yes,
students?
It's usually about two-thirds female, one-third male. It's the majors are variable. Generally, it's about half seniors. That's an artifact of how BC registers students. Seniors register first, so they think about it first. But very different juniors, freshmen. So even the occasional freshman who's really together and figures out quickly that this course is available. A variety of majors. BC is predominantly, of course, a Catholic university, but I've had Jewish kids, I've had Muslim kids, I've had Birthright alums. So I try to diversify largely by major, and I try, there is an interview, there's an application process to pick people who are just nice and will be pleasant and caring of each other on the trip, because we're bearing witness to very difficult things.
Has the trip really impacted the Jewish kids? Because in this country, or the Arab kids that might go, because in this country, we really don't get the coverage, the news, and the facts about what's really going on in Israel. So I imagine when they go over and see it, it probably is quite a
quite a shock. I think it is for all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, there are less than 1% Jewish students at BC, and so although I welcome them in the class, there just aren't that many of them.
Yeah.
And they are shocked, but I think not necessarily more so than other students. I mean, you go to Hebron and you see streets with concrete dividers down the middle,
right.
You know, and there's a Jewish-only side of the street and an Arab-only side of the street. Well, you've never seen anything like that in America.
Yeah.
You know, you don't meet people who's, well, you do, I guess, in communities of color, but BC students don't typically meet families whose sons have been gunned down by the army or the police. And so things like that are quite shocking, but I don't think particularly more so to Jewish students. They've read all the materials in the class, and so they're pretty, there's nothing we see that they haven't read about, although they often don't realize it until afterwards. They think, oh, hey, we read about that, and I'm like, yeah, we did.
Yeah. How is the course viewed on campus in BC? Are you getting any pushback on it? On many campuses across the country, there is pushback. Pushback against professors like you that dare to teach this. Pushback against organizations that are pro-Palestinian. I just wonder what you...
I have had a little bit of pushback, but largely from undergraduate students. There are three professors who don't like what I do. The first time, there was no pushback because nobody knew the first time that I was giving the course except my students. And then they came home. And another requirement of the class is that they do something to put their education back into the world. And I say to people, of course, my passion is human rights in this particular conflict, but if they are passionate about some other justice struggle, gay rights or immigrant rights or whatever, that's perfectly fine. That meets the requirements. So the first year we came back, and I did in that year have five Muslim American, Arab American students, and so they wanted to create an Israeli apartheid week, which they did, and a big wall on campus and had speakers come. And then, you know, there were three professors who were terribly unhappy about that and upset. And I'm told by hearsay that they advise their students not to enroll in the class. And then their students enroll anyway. That's how I get told about it.
Ends up being an endorsement for our kids, right?
It does often, of course, have that perverse effect. But the school itself supports the trip financially through a program that supports many study abroad and social service trips, and so I'm in that pot. You know, my chairs, my department has always supported it, so the pushback hasn't been bad. There have been some fairly immature undergraduate responses, but, you know,
which is to be expected,
almost funny.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I really can't complain. I think the truth is that because we're a Jesuit institution, we have relatively few Jewish students and probably also relatively few now, relatively few Jewish donors. We did at one time because in the social science building you see, you know, the Abraham Schiffman elevator and the, you know, Fleischman seminar room and so forth. So I think before Brandeis was created, BC got quite a lot of Jewish philanthropic donations, but I suspect now we don't.
Yeah.
So there aren't a lot of external pressures on the school. So I'm lucky that way. I just go ahead and do my work.
Now, when you came back from Israel-Palestine this past January, you wrote a fascinating article in Mondelweiss, the news service Mondelweiss. You started the article with this provocative paragraph, and I'm going to set you up with your own words, okay? Having just returned this week from a 17-day human rights trip to Israel and Palestine, my 10th in as many years, I conclude that the best description of the emerging situation is this. A perfect storm is coming. All the most destructive forces are aligning to produce possibly violent change and uncertainty early in the Trump administration. Unquote. Okay, that's a fantastic opening.
I
read that and said, oh boy, you know, she's on fire.
Yeah.
Okay, what's, I mean, you obviously had quite an experience. And you obviously are concerned about what's happening. So,
yeah, I think. Yes, I stand by that judgment. The worst forces on all sides are coming to the fore. I don't think, in fact, I would have, let me inflect that one way. The Palestinian forces are not terrible, they're just terribly weak. So Abbas is simply providing No real leadership that anyone has any confidence in. His electoral term ended in 2006, and he's been governing with executive orders ever since. And there's no sign of reconciliation among Palestinian factions. There's no sign of an election. And so I think the Palestinian voice continues to be very weak, but this is particularly strategically unfortunate at the moment, because the Israeli forces are moving more and more toward a preemptive one-state solution that involves annexation of all or part of the West Bank. Gaza is somehow not in that equation, but it will continue to be policed and oppressed. And so, you know, the Israeli political scene is moving, I think, quite rapidly toward annexation. Netanyahu, in spite of his now trip to Australia and the United States, is under the same kind of investigation that's led to Olmert's imprisonment. And so he's wounded, and he's trying to keep an alliance entirely with the people to the right of him intact. And so they're being more and more aggressive about demanding annexation. And then Trump, who, you know, in my view, doesn't know what he's doing at all, is opening the door to a one-state through annexation without the consent of the Palestinians, and not to become a democratic single state of all its people, but to become an apartheid state with, you know, one set of rules for Israeli Jews and another set of rules, actually multiple sets of rules, another set of rules for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then a third set of rules for Palestinians who will be, I think, soon annexed to Israel.
But even before Trump's election, it's quite clear that the two-state solution is just not a possibility anymore, and that the Zionist vision has always been take the land from the sea to the river, and they succeeded in doing that. And one could argue that the Oslo Accords was about really buying time.
Exactly.
And so Oslo Accords are passed. Nothing definitive is decided, really. There's no goal for borders or anything. Buys time. Israel just continues to take the land. And that's always been the goal.
That's always been the... I always want to give people I disagree with the benefit of a doubt. And so maybe, you know, for 5 minutes at the beginning of Oslo, somebody really thought there was a deal to be made there. But very quickly, it turned out to be that the whole peace process is a fraud. It's a cover for building settlements. But now I think we're in the end game, both because geographically, you know, there's just no more place. Everything's been taken. You know, all of Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, which is 22% of historic, or slightly less, of historic Palestine. So we're talking about now 11% that could conceivably be Palestinian. That's not contiguous. It can't be sovereign. It's not economically viable.
And people can't pass freely between any other.
Even different parts of what is left to Palestine. So, you know, the one state was always the Zionist intention. And to be fair, the one state was always the Palestinian preference. They never agreed to divide their homeland, and they've never seen any justice in, you know, the demand that they should divide their homeland to fix something which is a problem of European Christian anti-Semitism. So, in fact, the so-called universally agreed upon two-state solution, and I always put universally agreed upon in air quotes, you know, was a plan by imperial powers, the same idiots in Whitehall who drew lines on pieces of paper and created African nations of people who didn't want to be together. And so I've always been an advocate for a single democratic state of all its people, which would have to be multicultural, as every state needs to be in the 21st century. But now I think from the right wing, and with the intention of making it an apartheid state, we're seeing what was always the goal coming to fruition. We're right at that point where it's not going to be a goal, it's going to be what happened very quickly, I think.
I think the hope was that a lot of Palestinians would leave. I mean, their vision is all the land without the Palestinians, which isn't quite working out.
I mean, they have all kinds of sayings: maximum geography, minimum demography.
Yeah.
The intent was ethnic cleansing, and they, in the days before political correctness and in the early days of Zionism, talked about this very openly as the transfer. And they tried, even in still colonial times, to get the British to transfer all the Palestinians
right
out of their path. The British declined to do that. And then, you know, it's as though Zionist leaders every single morning get up and say, the ultimate goal is all of the land and none of the Palestinians.
Right.
And given the circumstances today, what is it we can get done toward that today? And there are two, you know, major strategies. One is physical coercion and violence, which is used, I think it's both brutal and horrible, and given Israeli military capability, could be far more lethal than it is. I mean, I think the violence is used semi-judiciously to send signals saying, we are capable of much worse, be careful. And so, you know, the story I tell, this is from the last trip. We have a bus driver on our trip whom we've worked with for a number of years now, and he's generally a very cheerful person. And he was looking really kind of grim one day, so I had seen the things the students were about to go see, so I sent them off. There are other faculty on the trip, not just me. And I sat with the bus driver and said to him, you know, you're looking kind of grim, what's up? And he said, well, you know, my nephew was 17, he was killed last week, and today we just got the report that the Israeli army is not going to investigate. And then he told me an absolutely horrific story, which I've since repeated, and the Israelis in the audience get very upset. So let me qualify that I'm not saying this is a typical story, but it is a story that is spread far and wide in the Palestinian community, and you can see how it serves as a kind of intimidation. So his nephew was 17. He got his first college acceptance. And he was ecstatic beside himself, jumping up and down and yelling and screaming that he'd been accepted to college. It was late in the afternoon. And suddenly all his friends showed up, and they were all dressed up in their, you know, go-to-wedding suit. And he said to them, how did you know I have this wonderful news? You're all dressed up for me. And they said, no, silly, you've forgotten. There's a wedding in the next village. We're not dressed up for you. We're going to the wedding. Put your wedding suit on and let's get going. So he changed his clothes, and off they went up 2-kilometer dirt road to the next village. And as you can imagine, a group of 17-year-old boys with great news jostling and shouting and making noise. So there's a settlement nearby, and the settlers called the army and said, you know, noisy Palestinian youth were frightened. And the army said, okay. And they declared the road to be a closed military zone, which they do by declaration. They didn't post it. They didn't go to the Arab village the Palestinian village where the wedding was and say, hey, that's now a closed military road. They just declared it amongst themselves. And so late that night, when these same group of boys was walking home to their village, probably also making some amount of noise, they suddenly found themselves surrounded by Israeli troops, IDF troops. And, you know, why are you here? Why are you, you know, suspiciously well-dressed? What's going on? And so all the boys pulled out their IDs and said, oh, we live in that village over there. We're coming back from a wedding, except the nephew, because he changed hastily. And so his ID was in his jeans at home on his bed. And he was a well-dressed young Palestinian male with no ID in a closed military zone. And so one of the IDF soldiers, a woman, she was like probably 18, she walked around behind him, jammed her rifle butt into the back of his knees. He fell to the ground, and she just leaned down and put her gun to his head and blew his brains out. And so Israelis will tell you that is against Israeli military regulations. That's probably true.
It
wasn't filmed.
Yeah, but we hear that story again and again.
It wasn't
almost
filmed
weekly.
Yeah.
Frankly. I mean, for them to deny that this isn't typical, I mean, they need to be reading Horace.
Exactly. But even if you think it's not typical, it's exceptional, it's now, you know, 20 other boys and all the surrounding villages know this story. And so it's intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's, you know, one means that's being used is physical brutality and intimidation. The more common is bureaucratic manipulation. And so, you know, you get stories of permits, the whole permit regime. If you want to widen the path from your house to your well, you need a permit. If you need to get chemotherapy in another country because there's no cancer treatment in the West Bank, you need a permit. If you want to go to a cousin's wedding, you need a permit. And those, of course, are used in a very manipulative way.
And all this to make life difficult with the hope that
they'll leave.
Tell a story in your article, the story of the village that built
the school.
The playground. Because, again, people may say this is not typical, but this is very typical. And it's the kind of oppression Palestinians face every day. But this is incredible.
Okay, so this is a story where Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are being bullied. Okay, they are Bedouin citizens of Israel, and they are living in a village called Khan al-Ahmar, which is now under complete demolition order. That has happened since we returned from the trip, and this is a tiny little village. So the Israelis have decided that the semi-nomadic way of life characteristic of the Bedouin is now unacceptable. It's not, from their point of view, good land use. And so they are trying now to contain the Bedouin in designed villages and to not let them be moving around the Negev with herds of sheep and goats. So they're building intentional communities for the Bedouin, which someone who didn't study history is eerily enough calling concentration villages. And this is why everybody should study history. But in any case, these particular Bedouin in Khan al-Ahmar have refused to be relocated. And so they're living in really shacks and tents in a cleft between two mountains, sort of tucked in between two mountains. And that little cul-de-sac they're in is surrounded on all sides by Israeli highways. And there's one little underpass under the highway that connects.
The only way in and out of the village.
In and out of the village.
Okay.
So they're really trapped in a very small space. And they themselves live extremely modestly in tents. But they want their kids to have a good education. So they built a rather handsome three-room schoolhouse out of tires and mud. They just stacked tires and then, you know, kind of caulked them with mud and painted the walls and painted, you know, lots of pretty pictures for the kids. And we went into the school. There are chairs and desks. There are blackboards. There are even a few computers. A lot of English lessons on the board. The kids are all bilingual. So this place is becoming a bit of a politically known place that diplomats go and photos are taken and so forth, because you can see the tires through the mud when you photograph the walls. And so an Italian diplomat came and said, oh, heck, we're going to donate some playground equipment, and he came back with playground equipment. Well, this is the eerie part. The neighboring Israeli village monitors these people with a drone. Now, I did not find out whether the drone was provided to them by the government or they just took it into their own heads to buy the drone. But anyway, they're monitoring this Bedouin encampment with a drone. So they called the police and said, I'm sure they have no building permit and they're putting up a playground. Come quickly. And the police came so quickly and demolished this playground that had been donated that the Italian diplomat, who was the donor, was still on the site drinking tea with the villagers who were thanking him for the playground when the police rushed in and demolished the playground. And so we saw the remains of the playground when we were there. Since we came back last week, the entire village has been ordered to be demolished, including the school, because obviously this is now becoming an embarrassment to the Israeli state, and you know a lot of people are going there and photographing it, and the social justice tours are going there. So now they're going to just destroy the whole thing with demolition orders.
This is within the Jerusalem? You said south of Ramallah, and it's
just slightly north of Jerusalem. Yeah, there. You know, 10-minute drive from Jerusalem.
But within
Israel, within 48.
Within
the Green Line.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, and these are Palestinian citizens of Israel. You know, the very first year we visited a guy in Al-Walaja, which is what we would call a neighborhood of Bethlehem. If you get in a car in Al-Walaja, you can be at the Church of the Nativity literally in 3 minutes. So we visited a guy named Mahmoud who was sitting in his home. We had tea with him in his home. And he had just gotten back from prison because he had been arrested for trespass. So we asked him, well, where were you trespassing? He said, well, by sitting here in this house. And we said, well, but we thought this was your house. And he said, yes, this house was built by my grandfather. My father was born in this house. I was born in this house. My three children were born in this house. But the neighborhood of Al-Walaja has now been rezoned from being a part of Bethlehem to being a part of Jerusalem. Jerusalem and Bethlehem are a distance of, let's say, Newton Center to the Watertown Mall, so very near. And it's as though you suddenly rezoned Watertown Square into Newton. I mean, you know, it would not to Americans make very much difference. But what happens in Israel is that Palestinians are not allowed to live in Jerusalem without a Jerusalem ID. So when the government rezoned this little neighborhood into Jerusalem, it refused to issue Jerusalem IDs to any of the inhabitants, and so they became trespassers in their own home. And Mahmoud was arrested for trespassing, so we met him the first year. The second year we went back, he was gone, his family was gone, but the house stood, it was under demolition orders. The third year the house was gone, the fourth year the wall had come right up on that property, and the fifth year there was a McMansion coming up over the wall on the Israeli side. So this is another way you get people to leave, through zoning, through house demolition.
That's how you steal land.
That's how you steal land. That's how you steal aquifers.
That's right. That's right. Which is how they take the land. And a lot of people don't really understand that. They just don't understand that that the way the land is being taken.
Yes.
Is this way.
Yes, and now, of course, since I returned from the trip, I returned January 7th, the Israeli Knesset has legalized retroactively, which I think is completely unprecedented in legal annals, that you can retroactively make things that were illegal at the time they were committed legal. Not just going forward, you can change the rules of the game, but you can change them retroactively. So they've now retroactively ratified that land taken by physical expropriation by settlers, that's legal. So you can, as a illegal Jewish settler in the West Bank, simply begin to build on your Palestinian neighbor's property, and the Israeli state will retroactively ratify that as legal, which is, you know, completely bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if there is the one state, of course there is a one state solution. It's one state now.
Yeah.
Certainly not two states. It shifts the way the occupation proceeds in a way. Right now in the West Bank, it's a military occupation.
Yes.
Differs somewhat from what Palestinians who live in Israel experience.
Yes.
What they experience is what the one state will be. That is, but there are some 50 laws or so that segregate them, that discriminate, you know, whereby they are denied benefits, education,
water,
travel,
schools,
all kinds of things. So this is the face of the one state that would be for the entire historic Palestine.
And at best.
And now the struggle becomes a civil rights struggle, in a sense.
Yes.
It is trying to create a state where all its citizens are equal.
Yes.
Equal benefits, equal rights, etc. And that's the struggle because Israel is a theocracy.
Yeah.
Israel has a set of laws for Jews and a set of laws for everyone else. And that is segregation, no matter how you cut it, no matter what words you use.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the mechanism within what the international community regards as Israel, so Israel inside the Green Line, the mechanism is that they have this very peculiar definition of citizenship that, again, I think is the only country in the world that does this. We use the term national and citizen interchangeably. You're an American national, you're an American citizen. For them, those are two different levels. So you can be a non-Jewish citizen of Israel. 20% indeed of their citizens are of Palestinian ancestry, some Christian, mostly Muslim. So you can be a citizen, and that gives you the right to vote, even to serve in the Knesset, to use the facilities of the National Health Service, to go to public schools. But you have to be a Jewish national, and the state here is doing something, again, peculiar in defining Jewishness as a nationality. You have to be a Jewish national in order to be allowed to buy land or in order to be entitled to family unification, so that if you are an Israeli Jew and you meet an American Jew at Boston College and you get married and you want to go back and live in Israel, there'll be no problem. Your American Jewish spouse has the right of return as a Jew and instantly becomes both a citizen and a national. But if you are a Palestinian born in 48 Israel and you meet a Palestinian from Ramallah at Boston College and fall in love and get married, you can't live with that person.
Right.
And the Israeli Supreme Court has two or three times affirmed that the Interior Ministry can impose these rules against family unification. And the language was very interesting of the Supreme Court. They said, you know, we're not obliged in the name of human rights to commit national suicide. And so we do not let Palestinian citizens of Israel bring spouses into the country from other places. So you don't have a right to family unification. So at best, that's the face of the one state. There's really four kind of levels of discrimination. One is sort of direct legal discrimination in which overtly Jewish people are given rights that are denied to others. And the best example of that is the right of return. I'm Jewish. I could go to Israel tomorrow and I would go to the head of the queue for a job. I would get instantaneous citizenship and
property,
and, you know, I'd be...
You get subsidized property.
I get subsidized property, right? I could, you know, move to a Palestinian house and expropriate it, right? So there's direct legal discrimination. Then there's indirect legal discrimination, which is laws that appear on their face not to name Jews and others as separate entities that appear to be race neutral, gender neutral, and so forth, but which in fact benefit Jews. So for example, ferocious veterans preference. Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel are forbidden to serve in the army. So only Jews serve in the army, and a few Druze.
And a number of benefits accrue from serving
in the military.
Those benefits are never accessible to anyone here.
That's right. But the law simply says veterans benefit, right. So it appears neutral on the surface. Then there's administrative latitude, as there is here. So all the executive branches of government, you know, put less money into schools in Palestinian communities, don't build good roads in Palestine. This is Israeli citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel. Don't get good roads, good schools, good clinics. Everything is understaffed, under-resourced. And then finally, there's a cultural thing that the whole culture of the country affirms the Zionist agenda. So you observe Jewish holidays, put the symbol of the Jewish religion on the flag. You have a ceremonial calendar that, you know, tells the story of the rescue from the Maccabees, the rescue from Egypt, the, you know, Fallen Soldiers Day, the Holocaust Memorial Day, and then Independence Day. So your whole ceremonial cycle says everybody's always trying to kill the Jews, and only through Israel do we survive. And of course that's, you know, not the story of
a number of people that don't know what's really going on over there say, well, what's the big deal? Why why won't the Palestinians allow or buy into the fact that the Jews should be a Jew, Israel should be a Jewish state? What's the big deal with that? Well, of course, the big deal with that is that's the basis for the
discrimination. Well, I mean, I certainly, as an American, would not pledge allegiance to a flag that had a crucifix on it. I'm Jewish.
That's right.
You can say America's a Christian state in terms of demographically, that's the majority religion. But, to say that it's institutionally reserves rights to Christian Americans that Jewish Americans or Hindu Americans don't have. No, that's not acceptable.
And that's the way I think we need to talk about it. We need to say, look, do you want a Christian state here in which Christians have some 50 laws which grant them benefits and rights not available to anyone else? Would you like that?
Yeah.
And they say, no. Well, this is what we're talking
about. Would you like to talk about America as a white country, which is...
Right.
What a good many Trump voters and people like Bannon are talking about, this sort of linking race to this form of hyper-nationalism. That's also what's going on in Israel.
Yeah.
So it's very scary and very ugly.
Yeah. People constantly ask me if I have any hope for a positive solution for the Palestinian cause, and I must admit that I don't have much hope as long as the United States continues to prop up and fund the Zionist project. The task for us activists is clear. We must challenge and change the unwavering support for the Israeli government by our Congress and our president and much of the U.S. population, which do not get accurate news and analysis from our mainstream media, and so remain largely ignorant concerning the realities of the occupation. I don't have to tell you how much work it will take to change that climate and how long that will take, but it is the essential step to Palestinian liberation. I mean, that's my take, and I wonder whether you see any hope here.
I do see hope in two places. One, I think you're right that the mission of, American support, and we should not, I think, in America be in the business of telling other people what to do. I don't think it worked out well for the indigenous people in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or anywhere else that we've entered in.
Or Native Americans.
Or Native America, or, Standing Rock. I don't think it's, we have a great track record in, telling other people what to do and having that work out well for them. But I do think that the work of advocating for a human rights standard applied to both sides, applied to any conflict, that work is going forward. I see pretty, I think America by and large changes its mind in churches and on campuses. And that's where I see the Palestine solidarity work taking hold in spite of the attempt to criminalize it and silence it and shut it down. For some obvious reasons, one, Israeli behavior is so glaringly awful to American eyes that are used to thinking about equality and civil rights. And also because, the Holocaust generation is dying off. And I think among younger Jews, I'm told more than 50% marry non-Jews. So Jewish identity is being redefined, as all identities get redefined over time as events change. But most of all, I want to say I do think it's critical that the American stance change to create some breathing room over there. But I think one should also not underestimate Palestinian sumud, which is a term they use to mean steadfastness. And so many people are not leaving. They're staying put, and there's an anecdote in that Mondo Weiss piece that I did. We do homestays in Bethlehem in Christian families. And so my host of my homestay this January, was a carpenter. And he has an ID issued by the Palestinian Authority. He has an Israeli biometric ID. He has a security clearance, sort of like our trusted traveler ID from the Israeli government. He has a businessman's card issued by the Israeli government because he runs a carpentry business. And he has a church-generated ID document because he works for the church as a carpenter. And so he's allowed to go from Bethlehem to Jerusalem every day to work, as long as he works only on church properties, churches, church-run schools, church-run hospitals. So one day, he comes to the checkpoint with his portfolio of identity documents and his tools, and the 18-year-old with the big gun says to him, "No, refused. Go away." And he says, "But why? I have all the right documents, and I was here yesterday. They let me." "No, refused. Go away." So he picks up his tools, because everyone who hires a Palestinian who has to come through a checkpoint from the West Bank knows that some days they're just going to be refused, and that's part of the deal. So he picks up his tools, prepares to leave, and the soldier says, "No, come back, try again." So he puts his hand on the fingerprint reader again. "No, refused." So this happens 5 times. The soldier refuses him, calls him back, refuses him, calls him back. So after the 5th time, this soldier, this 18-year-old with a big gun, looks this man who's probably 60 in the eye and says, "How do you feel when I do this to you? Do you feel humiliated?" And so this man said to me, "You know, I took a deep breath and I looked right back in his eyes and I said to him, 'No, I'm fine with your behavior. I'm getting to walk around. You're the one stuck behind the desk.'" That is Palestinian Samut.
Yeah, that's, you know, steadfastness.
That's steadfastness. They also, you have to know, the best educated Arab population, the highest school completion rates, the highest college completion rates, the highest PhD completion rates. For PhDs, they have to go out of the country, but the highest per capita PhD population in the Arab world. So they are getting on with their lives, and I think
that's part of the resistance. They see that, as part of the
resistance. I think that's part of the, yes, they say to exist is to resist. Yeah. And so, you know, it is not only our benevolence in changing the American view of this conflict, but it's also Palestinians who I think are fully capable of understanding that, although it will be very sad for many of them, that they have to reframe their struggle from a national liberation struggle to a civil rights struggle in a multicultural nation. But I think they're totally up to the task.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you for what you're doing to educate and involve a whole new generation of students in this struggle. And thank you for your writing. But most of all, thank you for your activism, because you have such a strong sense of justice, and that we need to communicate and that we need to rally around. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives. Our jobs, our incomes, our debts, those of our children, and those looming down the road. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Well, there are many things to discuss this week, but I'm going to focus a little bit more than I usually do on education, because of the important role it plays in our society and because of the economic revolution, and I really don't use that word so often, that's going on in the production and delivery of education in our society. Well, let me begin then with a story about education in our society that will give you an insight into part of that revolution. And my source here is a story in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And for those of you who are interested, that really is the best ongoing, regular source of information about what's going on, at least in higher education. And by that is meant colleges and universities. The Chronicle of Higher Education, February 12th of this year, had a story by Kevin Birmingham. Who is Kevin Birmingham and what's the story about? He's an instructor in English language and so forth at Harvard University. That makes him a bit of a special kind of person in the United States because of the prestige that Harvard works so hard to cultivate for itself. But he was nominated and was given the Truman Capote Award, given annually by the University in Iowa City. And this year, he gave a talk in receiving the Truman Capote Award. The award was given for his book, his first book. Kevin Birmingham's book is called The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce's Ulysses. The book, by the way, is a very interesting study of all of the difficulties James Joyce had, overcoming this censorship, overcoming people who reacted to his work as obscene because there were sexual references in it and so on. A book that is now recognized as one of the greatest achievements of modern literature, James Joyce's Ulysses. It's sobering to read a book that tells you how close we came to never getting that piece of literature into our mental development as a people. It gives you pause when you recognize how current prejudices can have such devastating effects. And no doubt there were other James Joyces we will never know about who didn't have the breaks he did to get it out. So Kevin Birmingham's book, The Most Dangerous Book, about that is well worth an award. And he got the Truman Capote Award. But that's not why I'm talking to you about it. In the award ceremony, he gave a speech that's available through the Chronicle of Higher Education, if you're interested. And the story and the speech he gave has the title, quote, The Great Shame of Our Profession. And by profession, he means college and university teachers. And I'm going to get to that in a moment because it is so important. Since, let's remember, colleges and universities are where Americans get whatever advanced education they ever get. Most Americans don't go to college, but if they do, then a section of those go on to graduate school. And in the college and the graduate school, what passes for higher education, education beyond the senior year in high school, that's where people get whatever education they get. So what goes on there shapes this society through shaping the skills, the aptitudes, the understandings of the world that we bring to our society. So let me tell you first about the award, because it tells you something just like the book it does, and we're not surprised that Kevin Birmingham tells us about it. The Truman Capote Award was created in the memory of Newton Arvin, an English professor at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. In 1960, Professor Arvin at Smith was charged with, I kid you not, lewdness and possession of obscenity after officers from the Massachusetts Pornography Unit ransacked his apartment. According to Kevin Birmingham, Arvin's real crime was that the sexually explicit material he owned was homosexual. In the course of the investigation, Professor Arvin apparently named two other untenured faculty members at Smith who also possessed allegedly obscene material. The courts, now this is important, folks, the courts ultimately overturned the professors, all of their convictions for these quote-unquote crimes. But Smith College suspended Arvin from teaching and cut his salary in half. He died 3 years later, a relatively young man. The two untenured faculty members he named were fired, and Smith College has never apologized for any of it. What happened to James Joyce continues to happen. And so Kevin Birmingham told that story and said, I want to use my award to say something about the shame of the profession. And by that he meant the shame of the college teaching, college and university teaching profession. And by shame he meant the insecurity, the injustice that is now suffered by the vast majority of college and university teachers. Let me tell you about that, since, of course, I am one as well. And so this is about me and my colleagues and the people I have worked with all my adult life as a university teacher. Today, tenured faculty represent 17% of college instructors. One out of six has job security. One out of six has a reasonable number of courses so that he or she can spend the time reading, thinking, studying, doing the research that make them an up-to-date, qualified teacher. From 1975 to 2011, Professor Birmingham explains to us, the number of part-time adjuncts, that's the name that's used, people who teach one or two or three courses, or maybe more at multiple universities typically, teaching two courses at college number one and one course at college number two and maybe another course at college number three, cobbling together a teaching job, something tenured faculty never had to do. And I was a tenured faculty all of my adult life at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. The case now is that the part-time adjuncts are a majority of the professoriate. A majority of college and universities teachers are now part-time adjuncts, and their number is growing faster than anybody else's positions in colleges and universities. And now the statistics you really have to hear to understand. 89% of college adjuncts work at more than one institution. 13% work at four or more institutions. And the reason they work at multiple institutions is obvious. The median pay, that is 50% of adjuncts get more than this and 50% get less. The median pay of an adjunct in the United States, according to a 2014 congressional report, is $2,700 per semester course. Folks, what that means is if an adjunct teaches five such courses, five, two at one university, then runs across town, two at another university, and then runs somewhere else the last day of the week, five at $2,700 a pop, this person earns $13,500 per semester or $27,000 per year. He or she is running around ragged. They couldn't possibly have time after grading the papers of how many? Of anywhere from 20 to 100 students per class. You're going to meet with them and talk with them about the issues they have? Probably not. Why not? Because you couldn't possibly do that in the time that you have. And grade the papers, and grade the exams, and meet with the students to explain where they got the answer wrong so that they really learn something. No, the reality is American colleges and universities don't care about the quality of the teaching. That's why they don't have tenured professors anymore. I had the time at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I had the time, 2 to 3 courses a semester, plenty of time for me to read, to study, to be up on what had to be taught, time to meet with the students for those one-on-one conversations that can make all the difference to how a student does in the course, to what a student gets from the course, and to what the whole experience means to a young person on his or her way to becoming a skilled contributor to our society. To be able to give you the statistics I just did, that the majority of college and university teachers are adjuncts, and that that majority is growing very fast, that only 1 in 6 tenured professors, only 1 in 6 instructors is a tenured professor, that is a comment on the quality of our education that is going to hamper and undermine the economic, social and political well-being of the United States for decades to come. Bravo to Kevin Birmingham for taking the Truman Capote Award for an important book on Ulysses and the struggle of James Joyce to get it published, but also even more to indicate that he wants to do something about the injustice to college instructors, having transformed the being of a professor from someone who really can learn and understand and have the space and the time and the support to bring that to young people, to really make a difference in their lives, wiping all that out to save money, because that's what it's about, folks. To pay a tenured professor is more expensive than to pay an overworked, harried, underpaid adjunct. That's all it was ever about. Public colleges are doing it because legislatures in the states don't give them the money they used to. I've given you the statistics in the past about that. It is a tragedy. It is a tragedy of enormous proportions. And I bring it to you in the hope that you can learn from it and become part of a solution to it, rather than imagining it can still somehow go on as if it weren't a crippling situation. Let me read to you one of the lines from Kevin Birmingham talk. Quote, one English department adjunct who responded to our survey said that she sold her plasma, that's her blood, on Tuesdays and Thursdays to pay for her daughter's daycare. Another woman stated that she taught 4 classes a year for less than $10,000. She wrote, quote, I am currently pregnant with my first child. I will receive no time off for the birth or recovery. It is necessary I continue until the end of the semester in May in order to get paid, something I drastically need. The only recourse I have is to revert to an online classroom and do work while in the hospital and upon my return home. And Birmingham concludes, and for those of you who are aware of gender issues, 61% of the adjunct faculty in the United States are female.
And you're listening to Economic Update with Richard Wolff. A listener-sponsored KPFA Radio. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and I need just 1 minute of your time to urge you to support this radio program and this radio station with a financial contribution of whatever you can afford, whatever you find reasonable, whatever you think we and this program are deserving of, and what you would also feel good about. It is your contribution that makes this radio program Economic Update possible. Now, our phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. just this 1 minute, because we are bringing you this program that you have tuned in to hear largely uncut. And here in our winter 2017 fund drive, and a very important fund drive that it is, my pledge to you will be a familiar one on this program. If we can raise the $3,000 that is our goal this hour that we have to do in order to carry our weight around here, well, next week my pledge to you will be once again to bring you economic update intact. $25 pledge makes you a basic member to this radio station. $50 is a great help. Even more than that helps more. We need to average about $100 pledge per person calling in or going online if we're going to make our goal. But that could be one person pledging $25 and another person pledging $175. Or that could be five people pledging $25 and another person pledging $400. It's what you can do, what's reasonable for you. Again, the number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. We now return to the program.
Let me turn to the next economic update. It has to do with the distribution of wealth in different societies. Here in the United States, it is often pretended that the distribution of wealth we have is only a little off of what is normal or typical in capitalist societies, particularly in relatively advanced industrial capitalist societies, not so different from our own. And that's therefore one oughtn't to be critical or to complain about the distribution of wealth, since it really does reflect how clever some people are, how hard they work, and wouldn't it be tragic to punish rather than reward the effort, the skill, the ingenuity, and so forth and so on and so forth and so on. Well, I looked into this, and I thought you might be interested, as I was, to compare the United States to four other countries that are in many ways like us, and to ask the question, two questions, really. One, is wealth distributed more or less in those countries the way it is here? And if not, why not, and what are the consequences? Okay, so here's the result, and I'm using here the work, as I have in the past, of the Piketty and Saez research groups, one located at the University of California in Berkeley, and the other one located at the University of Paris. One of the researchers, Gabriel Zucman, Z-U-C-M-A-N, has a 2016 report on wealth and poverty around the world, and that's where these numbers come from. So let's start with Finland. Finland. The richest 1% of people in Finland own 12.5% of the wealth. So it's only 1% of the people, and they have 12% of the wealth. That's an unequal wealth distribution. That 1% of the people, if things were distributed equally, 1% of the people would have 1% of the wealth. The richest 1% have 12% of the wealth, which means poorer people have smaller shares of the wealth in Finland. But Finland is an egalitarian society when we begin to look elsewhere. The second country I looked at, Canada. What does the richest 1% of people in Canada have? How much of the wealth of that country? 15.5%. More inequality than Finland. But now let's move right along. The next country was France. The richest 1% of the French people own 18% of the wealth of France. 1% owns 18% of the wealth. The next country, Germany, in some ways the most like us in Europe. In Germany, the richest 1% own 24.5% of the wealth. That's right. The top 1% own a quarter of the wealth. That's a very unequal society. Significantly more unequal than France, even more unequal relative to Canada, and extremely unequal relative to Finland. So now let's come to the United States. How much of the national wealth of the United States is owned by the top 1%? Here's the answer. 41.8%. That's right. The richest 1% own 41.8% of the wealth. Now, Finland, Canada, France, and Germany are all capitalist economies. They are economies in which the overwhelming bulk of goods and services are produced by private enterprises and distributed in markets. They are capitalist economies, but they do not allow anything like the level of inequality that we accept in the United States. We are the most unequally distributed society in terms of wealth of any of the advanced countries. We are an extreme outlier. What is this about? Why has this happened? And what are the implications? Briefly, but importantly, how did it happen? We have been, as a nation, extraordinarily vicious and violent in turning against the institutions that might have prevented this level of inequality. And that's clear from my research, because when you look at Finland, Canada, France, and Germany, they all have stronger versions of these institutions than we do. So there's a good hint that maybe the relative weakness of those institutions here is an important contributor to the extreme inequality of wealth here. Well, what are those institutions? Here they go. Trade unions, stronger in terms of their social position, often also in terms of their membership, but membership is a different thing in those societies than it is here. The social position of trade unions is stronger in all those countries than it is in the United States. Trade unions that advocate for their members, that push for higher incomes, that push for laws and rules and regulations that limit what corporations can do, all of those are stronger in those other countries than they are in ours. Here's another example. In every one of those countries, there are left-wing political parties that have considerable popular appeal and considerable electoral success. Some more, some less, and it varies at the times. But socialist parties, anti-capitalist parties, parties closely linked to trade unions and expressing their perspectives in a systematic way, all of that is more present in Finland, Canada, France, and Germany than it is in the United States. Which means that both the trade union and the political party that speaks for labor and constrains capital is what's missing here in the United States. And is it missing because we haven't experimented with it? Not at all. Trade unions were once much stronger in the United States than they are today. In the 1950s, a third of America's private sector workers were represented by a union. Today, it's less than 7%. So we know it was once that we had strong labor unions. We don't have them anymore. And likewise, we once had strong socialist parties, strong labor-based wings of the Democratic Party. We don't have either of those. Socialist, communist, and other anti-capitalist parties are tiny shadows today of what they once were. And the labor or progressive wing of the Democratic Party has been in decline for decades. although that may be turning around if the Bernie Sanders effort is any sign. Nor did the shrinkage of the labor movement and of socialist and communist parties happen in some quote-unquote normal way. These institutions have been repressed by the private sector and by the government. We've had Joe McCarthyism, we have had anti-leftism everywhere in our society, sustained by all kinds of politicians, by all kinds of private, well-funded groups. We've had a fairly vicious repression of the left for most of the last half century, so there's no surprise. But that inequality has consequences. When you have an inequality as extreme as that here in the United States, other things are extreme too. If 1% of the people together have 41.8% of the wealth, and that's what we have in America, then those 1% have to be, let me underscore that, have to be very worried that the mass of people looking at this inequality will take steps to use their vote, one person, one vote, to undo that inequality, to redistribute that wealth, or maybe even reorganize the economy so it never gets distributed like that in the first place, and therefore we wouldn't need redistribution. To protect against that, the 1%, if they have that much wealth, can devote a sizable chunk of it to keeping the rest of it. That's why politics is corrupted in societies with this kind of inequality. It's corrupted because the rich understand, especially here in the United States, where they are so extremely rich, and where, because of their extreme wealth, they can devote huge amounts of money to buying the parties, to buying the candidates, to pumping the airwaves full of messages to keep their wealth off the radar, to make people unaware of it, to make people concerned about other issues, to keep everything going in such a way as not to question or challenge or change the inequality that makes all this happen. If you are not satisfied with the economic conditions of the United States, please be aware that a capitalist system that gives so much of the wealth to so small a part of the population is a central cause of your economic distress. And that being angry at immigrants or being angry at government regulations is a mistake in terms of understanding, identifying where the basic problems lie. We have a system that generates a level of inequality that corrodes the institutions we depend on. We've reached the end of the first half of this program. Please remember to stay with us. We will be back after a very short interlude with the second half of today's Economic Update.
And a quick fundraising update before we turn to today's program, and perhaps an update on our technical situation here at this radio station. First, the update. Well, so far this hour, we've raised $100, a $100 pledge that just came online from Santa Rosa, and we're very appreciative of that. Our goal is $3,000. What am I talking about? This technical update. Well, one reason we may have only raised $100 so far is because our phone system was temporarily down, but it is now up and running. And if you tried to call in before, or if you haven't called in yet, well, you could do so right now and make that contribution to Economic Update and KPFA and help us in this winter fund drive so that we can continue to bring you this very important radio program largely intact. We're asking you for a pledge of whatever you can afford, what's reasonable for you, and what you will feel good about. The number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. $25 pledge makes you a basic member to this radio station, and we'll be very happy that you're with us. $50 pledge will help us get there. We need to average about a $100 pledge if we're going to make it. But again, that could be one person pledging $25, another person pledging $175. It could be one person pledging $500 or even $1,000, and perhaps pledging for folks that also rely on this radio program but perhaps can't make that contribution today. So the number again, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. We now return to the program.
Okay. Much of the time that remains for me today is going to be used to talk about economic theory. Don't worry, this is not going to be an abstruse lesson of the sort you might get in a bad class in a bad school. I'm going to try to make it clear, and I'm going to try to make it interesting. But we have to deal with this. Economics is not like fixing a car. If you want to fix a car, you go to a place where they teach you. This is the carburetor. This is the engine. This is how it works. This is how it breaks down. And this is how you fix it when it breaks down so that it works again. Things are kind of understood. They're fairly universal, car engines being what they are. And so you can become a mechanic and a skilled worker by learning how the engine is put together, what goes wrong, and how to fix it. Economics is not like that. What do I mean? The economy is part of the mystery of how human beings interact with one another. You know other parts of that mystery because we all confront those mysteries. Why do I find that person attractive rather than the other one? Why did I marry him or her rather than that other one? Why am I friends with this person but not with the other one? These are mysteries of relationships. And we spend much of our time trying to figure them out. And we make progress. We learn how or why, at least part of how or why, we marry the way we do and we have friendships the way we do. And this job works for us and that one doesn't. And this neighborhood is attractive and that one isn't, etc. Well, the economy is like that. We don't experience the economy in the same way. If you are the head of a big corporation, you do not experience the economy in the same way that a person does who drives a truck, even if it's in the same corporation. If you're a farmer, you do not experience the economy the way you do if you're an office worker. You don't. And that's not a fault or a failure. That's the way the world is. But it's even more complicated. If you were educated in certain ways, you were taught to think about the economy in certain ways. And if someone else taught you with a very different approach, then you learned that approach. It turns out that economic systems are understood and experienced differently by different people, and it has always been that way, just like human beings understand love, sex, friendship, and all the other important relationships in life in very different ways. And indeed, one of the fascinating and interesting things about life is to encounter, to discover other ways of looking at the world. It will change us. If I look at it in one way and I encounter a person who looks at it in a different, my perspective will be changed. I will now be more sensitive. I will understand, even if I don't agree with, other ways of thinking about the world. It's a little bit like discovering that there are other kinds of food preparation than the one you grew up with. You don't have to like them as well, but they're interesting. They're tasty. From time to time, you would like to taste it again. So here in New York, for example, one restaurant offers sushi, and one restaurant Tex-Mex, and another restaurant Chinese food, and so on. And people in New York love that about this city, that you can literally go to a different corner of the world whenever you want to taste. How differently human beings have understood the relationship between us and the food we eat. So let's do the economics. How do we get into it? Well, I give that a lot of thought. Because when I teach economics,
I teach it in what we call a comparative perspective. I don't teach economics as if it were carburetor or car engine studies. The economy isn't a thing that it works in this way that we can learn and figure out how to fix. That makes economics boring, mechanical, and technical, when what is exciting about it is precisely how differently people eat. Imagine if I gave you a course about food, and all I talked about was, here's how you cook the hamburger, here's how you cook the French fries, and therefore, here's how you make food. Eventually, you'd figure out that that isn't about food. That's about one kind of food, and you don't want to be limited to just that kind. You'd like to at least know what the other ones are. It would be as if I taught you a course on religion, but the only religion I told you about was, let's say, a Unitarian Universalist religion. After a while, you'd say to me, look, I'm perfectly happy learning about Unitarians and Universalists, but aren't there other religions too? Like Roman Catholicism or Muslim religion or Jewish religion or and so on and so on. You want to understand that people engage with divinity, God, the spiritual, if you like, in different ways, just like they engage with food in different ways. Well, friends, your education is narrow, stunted, and inadequate if you think economics is one way to go. Now, why do I stress that? Because that's how it's taught in the United States, and that's how it's been taught for most of the last 50 years. We do not admit to most of our students in most of our colleges and universities that there are alternative ways of understanding what an economy is, how it works, what's wrong with it, and how to fix it. There are multiple ways of doing that, just like there are multiple ways of singing or dancing or eating or dressing or praying or anything else, particularly anything else that really matters in life. And our economy matters, just like our eating matters and our religions matter and so on. So I am now, in the time that I have, going to try to address the different ways you can understand the economy. One last reason before I do it, why? Because economics has been so narrowly taught in the United States, because only one way of thinking about it dominates, almost to the exclusion, not quite, but almost to the exclusion of other ways, our economic leadership in companies, in the government, has been poor. We have had, for example, a crash in 1929, a terrible crash that gave us a depression, that's what it's called, that lasted for 11 years, roughly, from 29 to 41. One of the reasons we had that terrible crash is we didn't have the insight, the understanding to see it coming. We didn't understand, once it came, why it was there. And we didn't understand real well what to do about it, which is why it lasted 11 horrible years. And did we at least learn after that? Not really very well. The narrowness of our economics prevented us from asking and answering crucial questions. And that's part of the reason why in 2008, capitalism in the United States and beyond crashed again. And once again, the profession didn't see it coming. And once again, once it hit, they didn't understand why. And once again, they couldn't fix it, which is why here we are, 8 years, 9 years later, in 2017, a crash that happened in 2008, and we're still, most of us, living in the consequences. The terribly damaging consequences. That should have been more than enough evidence to suggest that the way we were teaching, studying, learning, and using economics was inadequate, was too narrow, missed too much. But it didn't. It didn't. And that's because there are reasons why we teach what we teach, even though it doesn't work very well. Dangerous way to run your society, but it's the one that has dominated in our society.
We are now three-fourths of the way through today's program, and we have raised $1,000 towards that $3,000 goal. So we are a third of the way towards that goal. I do want to thank several people who have now made that pledge this hour, including Jonathan in San Francisco and Shauna also in San Francisco, Sue in Richmond, Angelica in Tarzana, and also we have Diana in Berkeley. Thank you so much. We have a mix here of $25 pledges and $40 pledges, even $136 pledges. And then we have, you know, a $500 pledge and a $200 pledge in here. So it's everyone doing what they can, and that's what I'm asking you to do as well. And you could join these people by supporting Richard Wolf and Economic Update by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. Today, folks, this hour, no bells, no whistles, no thank you gifts, no challenges, no gimmicks. We're stripping this down to the essentials of what public broadcasting is really about, and that means you supporting a radio station that is the sole objective is try to broaden the horizon of our own life. So the number again, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. We now return to the program.
So what is that way? It's called neoclassical economics. We don't have enough time to go into why it has this funny name, but it does. That's a matter of the history of how it arose. And in this view, capitalism is a magnificent economic system. Neoclassical economics is not neutral about capitalism. It loves capitalism. It doesn't just love capitalism, but it loves a particular kind of capitalism. It's the kind with very little government intervention in the economy. Indeed, from a neoclassical perspective, all we want from the government is to make sure that nobody interferes with this beautiful system called capitalism. A system which is perfect, which rewards everybody in proportion to what they contribute. If you are rich, it's because you've contributed a lot. If you're poor, it's because you haven't. It's very morally loaded this way. It's a system in which what gets produced is what people want. So it's kind of fair. It's kind of responsive. It's consumer-oriented, if you like that language. It's a system that's self-healing. If anything goes wrong, it fixes itself. You don't need the government to come in. You just let it be. Let the private individual buy and sell, buy the goods and services he or she wants, sell whatever they have to contribute to production, their labor, if that's all they have, or their capital, if they have some wealth, or their land, if they own some. You contribute what you wish and have, and you get in proportion to what you contribute. Fairsies, you might call it. A wonderful system. That is the best way to organize an economy that the world has ever achieved, and therefore it should be celebrated, which is what neoclassical economics does, and it should not be interfered with, which is the message that neoclassical economics gives to the journalists who write about the economy, to the politicians who run the government, and to the leaders who own and operate the enterprise. Neoclassical teaches the private economy is what should dominate, is the best thing that could happen, should be left alone, and works perfectly. Nobody has anything to complain about. Your income is your reward for what you contribute. Don't complain. If you want more, contribute more. And if you don't have more to contribute, if you don't have more labor you can do, if you don't have more capital you can offer, if you don't have more land you can make available, then it's your fault. and you have to live with whatever rewards you get for what contribution you make. This is a celebratory system. This is what is taught in American colleges and universities 95% of the time. 5%, not quite. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But this is what is taught. Therefore, you shouldn't be surprised that journalists, when they write about economics, write as if we live in this wonderful system that works really beautifully and that the government should keep its hands off and nobody should break the rules. And if there's a problem, the market, the system will solve it itself. And you shouldn't be surprised that corporate leaders love this because it says they're in charge of an enterprise which can do everything it wants. The government is not going to interfere because that would only make things bad. This is what the people who run this society want. Politicians are told to think like this. That's why you can hear politicians so often saying these weird things like, let the market decide. Let the private enterprise system work its way. These are people who believe this. And after all, they were taught it over and over again. They got it from their newspapers and TV. They get it from their political leaders. Of course they believe it. But is this the only way to look at the economy? And the answer is an absolute, unqualified no, no, no. To imagine that this is the only way to understand the economy is the same thing as imagining that the only way to have a meal is to eat hamburgers and French fries. Or the only way to pray is in the manner of Unitarians and Universalists. It is to misunderstand a part of the story for the whole story. And that does you no service and is no compliment to your smarts. So here we go. Here's the first alternative. The first alternative is called Keynesian economics, named after John Maynard Keynes, a British economics professor at Cambridge University, who in the depths of the Great Depression of the 1930s looked around him and said, I see a quarter of the people unemployed. I see poverty and misery all around me. Don't tell me capitalism is a wonderful system that works beautifully, that produces wealth, prosperity, economic growth, that gives everybody what they deserve. Stop it. You're describing an economy that may be a utopian dream you have, but it does not describe, and therefore it is not going to help us fix, an economy that is clearly not working well. This was a bombshell for many. This was a man, John Maynard Keynes, who had been an accomplished practitioner of neoclassical economics, but who was realistic about what he saw in the Britain of his time, which was as devastated by the Great Depression as the United States was. And he said, capitalism, private enterprise, markets, left to themselves, can, and here clearly have, produced social and economic disasters, crashes, poverty, unemployment, misery, inequality, economic instability. Should I go on? And Mr. Keynes didn't waste a minute. He developed an explanation for how private enterprise capitalism can produce these disasters and what should be done about it. And to make a long story short, he said there were mechanisms normal and natural to capitalism that could and regularly would produce economic horror stories, disasters, failures, miseries, inefficiencies, depressions. And the solution, he said, was for the government to step in systematically. The government should pump money into the economy when it turned down to build it up again. That the government should, if the private sector wasn't spending enough money to keep people in their jobs working and producing, well, then the government should step in. It didn't even matter to Keynes. Buy anything you want. take in each other's laundry, build national parks, do whatever it is that has to be done. Keep people working by having the government buy whatever it thinks might be useful to build. But the government has to come in, otherwise capitalism self-destructs. This is a very different economic theory. Most schools in the United States don't teach it. And if they do teach it, they have one or two faculty doing that. Everybody else is parroting the old neoclassical song and dance. But is Keynesian the only alternative? Not at all. The third big one, Marxian economics. And here's the big difference about it. Neoclassical economics celebrates private capitalism. Keynesian economics says private capitalism is good, but only if controlled, regulated, supplemented by government intervention. Otherwise, the bad parts of it drown out the good parts of it. But Keynesian economics likes capitalism. It just wants it with a heavy dose of government involvement, which freaks out the neoclassicals who don't want any government. And so that's been the debate between them. More or less government, more or less government intervention. Marxian economics, completely different. For Marxian economics, the problem isn't more or less government. The problem is capitalism itself. This system of organizing production so that a tiny group of people at the top, the board of directors, make all the decisions and the mass of employees do what they're told. For that, for Marxism, that's the problem. You have an undemocratic economic system and it undermines democracy everywhere else. You have a system that gives a small number of people the dominant say. They'll make the system work for them and not for everybody else. And that's why you get the inequality that we talked about in the first half of today's program. No. The Marxian argument is you have to change the economic system at the foundation. You have to finally bring democracy to the workplace. All the workers together, collectively and democratically, decide what happens in the enterprise. Not a handful of shareholders, not a handful of board of directors elected by the shareholders. No. The autocracy, the non-representative nature of the leadership of enterprises, that's the core problem, and that has to be fixed. Otherwise, you will have recessions and depressions and crashes. The government coming in, as Mr. Keynes proposed, wasn't enough to stop us from having another crash in 2008, and not having learned what the Marxists want us to see, which is the crash in 1930s, was also a problem of the underlying system. Why would a country like ours be this way? Why would we continue to teach one way of thinking when it hasn't worked real well and the alternatives are obvious? And the answer is fear. For 50 years, the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union made Americans fearful about the Soviet Union. It talked about Marxism, so they didn't want to talk about that at all. If you talked about it, you lost your career. You lost your job. You were in trouble. A little bit like James Joyce trying to write his novel. You were censored. You were pushed away. It's a tragedy. It's intellectually dishonest, and it's a tragedy for our country. We need all the insights and all the theoretical avenues available to our people to solve our problems. Shutting us out of two of the three major theories in the world today is self-destructive. It's only done to fearfully support the status quo. What the corporations now like, they are not the problem. It's the government intervention, it's this, it's something else, it's immigrants, but it's not the system itself. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your partnership. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission, we put the crowd loud, hip hop and rhythm is hitting, we wanna make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we are in the KPFA Winter Fun Drive. And on the program, we have John Pilger. We have the award-winning filmmaker, journalist, author, John Pilger. His latest film, his documentary film, is called The Coming War on China. And, of course, people here at KPFA know who John Pilger is. He's done so many fantastic films over the years. John Pilger was born in Australia, began his career there. Although he's now spent most of his adult life in Britain, he worked at the Daily Mirror newspaper for 23 years. For another 23 years, wrote a column for the New Statesman magazine. But John Pilger is best known for his documentary films. He's made more than 50. Some of his most influential works covered the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, Australia's treatment of its Aborigine population, the continuing oppression of Palestine, and the many U.S. interventions in Latin America. And, of course, one of our favorites here at Project Censored was The War You Don't See, which was a film that actually went through, experienced some censorship, and John Pilger actually wrote about that issue in Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. John Pilger contributed a chapter to the Project Censored book about that film and the issues surrounding it. So we are joined now by phone with John Pilger. John Pilger, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Very good to be back. Thank you.
Hi, John. This is Peter Phillips. Great to have you back.
Hi, Peter.
It's good to have you. I loved watching your film yesterday. It's just incredible. Mm-hmm. This is the coming war with China, and clearly you are making an attempt to break the silence on this in the United States. This is a topic that just doesn't get covered. And in one sense, you say the U.S. is already at war with China. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, that's actually the view in the film of James Bradley, the author who has written a landmark book called The China Mirage. It's one of Bradley's revelation of the hidden history of the relationship between the United States and China, in a sense, breaks the silence. But there is so much silence to break around China and the real dangers that all of us face with a United States seemingly bent on asserting its dominant role in the Asia Pacific. A new situation has arisen where we have an economic power almost as great as that of the United States. Possibly in the next year or two it will be greater. The great superpower has never known anything like that. Even in the days of the first Cold War, Russia presented was a superpower, but it was a military superpower. It wasn't an economic superpower. China has created, if you like, an image of the United States in Asia. It's played America's game in many respects, and beat America at that game. That to those in the United States who believe that the U.S. is not only the as Henry Luce said, the arbiter of the 20th century, it's also the arbiter and controller of the 21st century. Well, that's not so anymore, but that has set up a very dangerous situation.
Some of the things I learned in the film, you have a wonderful history of the U.S. involvement in China, going back to opium trade. and the enrichment of certain families here in the United States. Talk about the Boxer Rebellion, and you go into all the way up to the present time, where I learned from your film that there are actually more billionaires in China than there are in the U.S. And that was fairly amazing to me. But the difference that you lay out quite clearly is the billionaires in China do not run the government. They are, in fact, almost separate. The party runs the government, and the party makes policy changes. And those changes have been quite are pretty much pro-capitalism. I mean, that's what they're doing today. So,
well, the billionaires don't run the government, but undoubtedly they have an influence on the government, and it's a very arcane situation in China. So we're not absolutely sure the extent of their influence. But the point you make there, which was made by a very fluent and erudite entrepreneur called Eric Lee in Shanghai, he said that is the difference between the U.S., that in the U.S., the billionaires actually, if not directly run the government, well, looking at Trump's group, most of them are getting on to be billionaires, if they're not that already. But the influence of this billionaire oligarchy is such that it is controlling in the United States. The billionaires in China are undoubtedly held at arm's length by the what might be called the Politburo and the State Council and the various layers of Chinese government and administration. In fact, one of the most virulent Chinese government campaigns is anti-corruption at that high level. And a number of billionaires, which you would have thought had a great deal of influence in government, have found themselves being investigated, and several have found themselves prosecuted. So that separation, there seems to be a separation. As I say, I'm not absolutely sure because I don't know enough about the networks between people of power in China, but there seems to be a separation between that power of capital and the political power. It's put it this way, it's enough of a separation for the Chinese government, the Chinese political power, to be able to command the heights of the economy and the political economy in that country. That's not so in the United States. And that's the point that Eric Lee was saying. It's the other way around, that clearly the power of capital rules. I don't think we need any lesson on how it rules, but it rules in the United States. So this is a very destabilizing time for power in the United States. It looks across the Pacific, and in less than a generation, this economic power, which appears to be capitalist, it is certainly a market economy, but it is a regulated and in many respects controlled market economy, has risen. It's not only a market economy, it makes things. Whereas the United States has stopped making things, stopped making a lot of things apart from armaments and chips and various other things. But the workshop of the world, the capitalist workshop of the world, is in China. So that is perceived as the new enemy, or rather the new threat to American dominance. And the way the American power class has reacted has been military. In 2011, Obama announced the pivot to Asia, this strange, rather innocuous term actually meant that 60% of all U.S. air and naval forces would be relocated in the Asia-Pacific by 2020, and that is happening. You have a great economic power rising, being faced by still the world's greatest military power, and getting greater if Trump is going to add his $54 billion to the so-called defense budget. That's a scenario for conflict and confrontation, mistake, accident, misunderstanding, all those ingredients that can lead up to war.
We're speaking with award-winning filmmaker, documentarian, journalist, author. We're talking to John Pilger. And John Pilger's joining us on the Project Censored show today, talking about his latest film, The Coming War on China. And if you are online, of course, you can see John Pilger's work. And we've linked, in fact, to the Project Censored Facebook page, The Coming War on China, Nuclear War is No Longer a Shadow, which was a piece published last year. It's on Global Research, among a number of other places. And so we'd certainly like to share John Pilger's work with you, both writing and this brilliant new documentary film. It was released late last year, and it is available here today at KPFA during the winter fund drive. So remember that this is a fund drive program. The number to call is 800-439-5732. You can get a copy of John Pilger's latest film, The Coming War on China. And we are very fortunate to have John Pilger on the phone with us. And we would very much like to carry on our conversation with John Pilger. But we need to remind the listeners that this premium is available, and we need you to help support Free Speech Radio, and particularly the Project Censored show here. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. We were able to get the film, and you can get it for a $100 pledge. We also have Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition, our latest book at Project Censored, for a $120 pledge, both for $200. John Pilger's Coming War on China film and the Project Censored latest book, Censored 2017. You can pledge online at kpfa.org, but please keep the calls coming throughout the program. 800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. John Pilger, we were just speaking about the current issue with China militarization, and you write and discuss this by framing it this way. The United States, of course, you just talked about the pivot to Asia. But it's the case that China is really surrounded by U.S. bases, U.S. interests. We have certainly seen a ratcheting up of rhetoric regarding the potential threat of China in the Trump campaign and now the Trump presidency. Do you see how do you perceive this issue with China? Do you see that in China, that increasingly China is seeing the United States as a militaristic threat? Or do you believe that China is at all a military threat to the United States in coming days?
Well, I think China has become to see the United States as a military threat. And they've started to prepare. The provocations of the bases that you have just mentioned have had a very rational reaction in China. China has has started to build defenses, and those defenses include airstrips on disputed reefs and islets in the South China Sea, in the Spratly Islands. And it's very interesting and very symptomatic of the way we get our news in the West that whilst China's so-called militarizing of these small islands in its own waters, in effect, in the South China Sea, has been a major news issue. The reason why has not. It's been left out completely. And the reason why is that China is surrounded by 400 U.S. military bases. And these are very active military bases on which there are missiles and bombers, and there are warships and nuclear submarines and drones, and they extend in a great arc all the way up from Australia through to the Pacific, through the Pacific Islands, through the Philippines, all the way up through Japan and Korea and across Eurasia. It's an encirclement of U.S. bases. And in the film, I've used what I think are telling maps showing how China is threatened, and very clearly threatened by the presence of these bases. I've used the work of David Vine, whose excellent book, Base Nation, is the result of several years of research of the numbers of bases that the U.S. has right around the world. And David's research shows very clearly that China has been encircled, and the military threat is pretty well one way. The threat to the United States, well, there isn't a military threat to the United States from China. There just isn't. But what there will be is the threat of China preparing to defend itself. For example, China has increased its nuclear alert, that is, it's put its nuclear weapons on high alert. They used to be on low alert. That meant that the warheads and the rockets were kept separately. No longer. China has is developing a fleet of that could challenge the Trident missile fleet, able submarines able to launch nuclear weapons from submarines. China has developed a number of missiles that are aimed at groups of warships. Very specific military development has gone on in China in recent years. Now, this is almost counter to almost the political philosophy in China, which one of the reasons they've been so successful in their economy is that they've looked at the Soviet Union and why it collapsed, how it collapsed beneath the burden of so much of its state armaments industries and its attempt to see off the United States as the world's first superpower in military terms. China never wanted to do that. It wanted to develop in economic terms. That was the message, the very clear message of Deng Xiaoping, the man who changed China, when he came to power in 1979. This was to be the rebirth of China, the end of what they call the century of humiliation, the end of exploitation. It was the rise of China as a massive economic power. And what they've done in that time has been some have been quite extraordinary. I mean, there have been casualties of this, of course. Division has increased within China, but at the same time, they have raised from from poverty some 500 or 600 million people into an entirely new middle class, which is the diametric opposite of what has happened in the United States, where the military, where the middle class is being decimated. But now, with a threat from the United States, the U.S. threatened that its dominant role in the world is being seriously challenged. China is now beginning to militarize fairly quickly. Its defense budget has, I think, gone up to about $150 billion, which is small compared to what the U.S. one is of about $600 to $700 billion. But it's considerably more than what it was a few years ago. That suggests a great risk. I see the difference between these two great powers, almost the difference between the old and the new. The United States is a kind of 19th century power with Silicon Valley and nuclear weapons. You know, it plays gunboats game. If they were Britain in the days of Lord Palmerston, in Washington, they'd all be wearing pith helmets. It's a sort of kind of old-fashioned imperialism,
John,
19th and early 20th century.
Yeah, Mickey and I are cracking up here.
We've got the imagery for sure.
John, that was...
China is a 21st century nation.
What's so...
Go ahead. 21st century nation.
Yeah, it's a 21st century nation. It's been created, basically, for the 21st century. When you have the Chinese president going to Davos, to the apex of the great globalization cabal there, and defending globalization, you know, while the U.S., which has been the architect of globalization, now wants to... It seems wants to dismantle the various multilateral agreements that underpin this globalization.
You're saying, and what this film is about really is the danger that the U.S. will deliberately start a war with China, and there'd be a variety of ways that could happen. It could be
not necessarily deliberately, no,
or accidentally. But we're strategizing in that regard.
Yes, you know,
Trump's.
But look, it's 100 years since the First World War. Well, it was in the middle of the First World War then. But the First World War began with a lot of very cynical, deliberate action, but a number of trade wars as well, a lot of posturing, a lot of misunderstanding, accidents, mistakes. Once you create a provocative atmosphere between states, that unless you have a very reliable mechanism of diplomacy that can diffuse that, then it's dangerous. That's the situation at the moment.
We'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are joined by the great documentarian, journalist, and author John Pilger. We're very grateful that John Pilger, all the way, it's tomorrow, I believe, in John Pilger's world, halfway around the world, and we are delighted that he is taking time to join us on the Project Censored Show today. If you're not familiar with John Pilger, for some strange reason, you have a lot of catching up to do, and what a good place to start would be the newest film from John Pilger, The Coming War on China. And we have that film available for a $100 pledge to KPFA Free Speech Radio. $100 gets you The Coming War on China by calling 800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. For a $120 pledge, you get Censored to 2017. That's our 40th anniversary edition. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. Coming War on China, John Pilger, movie for $100. The Censored Book, $120, both for $200. And look, in a six-month installment plan, that's $33.33 a month. And that would certainly help things here at KPFA. Plus, you'd have this brand new, excellent film, The Coming War on China by John Pilger. 800-439-5732. Won't you join Roger in Novato, who has called in and pledged this hour, along with some other folks? So please call 800-439-5732 online at kpfa.org.
I can't praise this movie more highly. This is a topic that just simply isn't covered in the United States or corporate media. There's a Trump demonizing of China that's ongoing, has been throughout his campaign. There's a continued threat and misinformation about, quote, communist China, when in fact they are more capitalist or as capitalist as the United States. And I, you know, this film is highly educational. Certainly vital for people to understand. And for a $100 pledge to KPFA, keeping free speech radio alive here in Berkeley and Northern California, it's a vital support. So by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online at www.kpfa.org, you can pick up this DVD, The Coming War on China by John Pilger, for a $100 pledge, or the Censored 2017 40th Anniversary Book for $120 pledge, or both for $200. We need your support. We need you to keep KPFA going and alive, and we really thank you to call right now.
That's right, Peter. And, you know, Project Censored Show has been on air for 6 years, and we're on about 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Of course, we're on the Internet and around the world for podcasts, and people listen all over. We get emails from all over the world, people listening. But we're based right here in Northern California, and KPFA Free Speech Radio is our home, and we are asking for you to help support KPFA. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. The Coming War on China, fantastic and very timely new film by John Pilger, $100 pledge, and the new Censored 2017 book. So please call in. That would be $120 pledge. $200 gets you both of them. That's $33 a month on a six-month plan. 800-439-5732. Let's do this now. Let's actually share with you. We were able to work with John Pilger and Bullfrog Films and some of the folks that John Pilger works with, and they were kind enough to get us audio clips and also a video, a quick copy online of the video so we could preview it before the program. But we'd like to share some of the audio with you so you can hear for yourself what's happening. So let's hear an audio excerpt from the opening minutes of The Coming War on China by John Pilger.
I pity a country that would come up against us. The synergy with air, land, and sea forces and our ability to control the battle space and seize the high ground is devastating. All countries respect the power of the United States, and they respect how dominant we are in this region. And we get better and better and better.
Tonight at 10, a rare glimpse of China's ambitious expansion in one of the world's most contested regions. We report from the South China Sea, where the Chinese are warning off anyone who comes too close to their building program.
We continue our look this morning at what China does not want you to see. The United States says the superpower is reclaiming land in the South China Sea.
The fact that we're dealing with a situation right now where we, the U.S., has to be much more aggressive in dealing with the Chinese government.
CNN has learned that the U.S. Navy is about to send a destroyer there. Let's go to our CNN chief.
CNN got exclusive access to classified U.S. surveillance flights over the islands.
The threat of China is becoming big news. The media is beating the drums of war as the world is being primed to regard China as a new enemy.
China's alarming creation of entirely new territory in the South China Sea is one part of a broader military push that some fear is to challenge U.S. dominance in the region.
China is building airstrips in the South China Sea on disputed islands condemned by an international tribunal. This is now a flashpoint for war between China and America. What is not news is that China itself is under threat. These American bases form a giant noose encircling China with missiles, bombers, warships, all the way from Australia through the Pacific to Asia and beyond.
I mean, if you were in Beijing looking out, you stood on the tallest building in Beijing and looked out at the Pacific Ocean, you'd see American warships. You'd see Guam is about to sink because there's so many missiles pointed at China. You'd look up at Korea and see American armaments pointing at China. You'd see Japan, which is basically Japan's a glove over the American fist. I think if I was Chinese, I'd have a little to worry about American aggressiveness.
And we have China surrounded, and we're doing more all the time to try and keep it surrounded and deepen that containment of China. But China presents a fascinating case of a country that is independent, doesn't have foreign bases on its territory, growing very rapidly, not as rapidly now as it did for 30 years, but still the second-ranking economy in the world.
We have an adversary. And that adversary is China. And that adversary, unless there is dramatic reform inside China, will be our enemy someday.
One myth, I think, really that needs to be dispelled is that somehow China's aiming to replace America and going to run the world. It's not, well, first of all, the Chinese are not that stupid. The West, with its Christian roots, are about converting other people into their beliefs. The Chinese are not about that. It's just the I'm not degrading the Western culture. I'm just pointing out the inherent nature, the DNAs of two different cultures. The Chinese 2,000 years ago built the Great Wall to keep the barbarians out, not to invade them.
As the world's economic power moves rapidly to Asia, the response of the United States is to deploy the majority of its naval forces to Asia and the Pacific. This massive military buildup is known in Washington as the pivot to Asia. The target is China. The great power game in the 21st century is called perpetual war. America's unchallenged arms industry, the annual prize is huge profits from almost $600 billion of military spending.
That's a clip from John Pilger's latest film, The Coming War on China. It was released late last year. It's a wide-ranging documentary looking at the history of U.S. military activities in the Pacific, U.S. attitudes toward Asian and Pacific peoples, current conditions inside China. And again, you just heard that last piece there with John Pilger himself talking about the $600 billion military spending budget in the United States. And for a sense of perspective on that U.S. military spending figure, $600 billion is bigger than the entire economies of most nations. It's bigger than the economy of Iraq or the economy of Vietnam or the economy of Sweden. It's twice the size of Portugal's economy or the Greek economy. These are staggering, staggering figures. And the United States has military forces deployed in 70% of the world's nations. And so this is also part of the conversation that takes place in John Pilger's film, The Coming War on China. And we have that film available for you for a $100 pledge. That's a $100 pledge for this riveting two-hour documentary on the coming war with China by John Pilger. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. 800-439-5732. We really need you to call and support Free Speech Radio, Project Censored. But more importantly, you know, we need to know you're out there and you are listening and you appreciate this kind of programming. We've been doing this at Project Censored for 6 years here on KPFA on nearly 40 stations now. $100 pledge gets you John Pilger's new film. $120 pledge gets you the newest Project Censored book, Censored 2017. That's the 40th anniversary version. And you just heard me a minute ago say U.S. military forces are deployed in 70% of the world's nations. That's the number one underreported story from last year by Nick Terse reporting for Tom Dispatch. And that is an absolutely amazing figure. And these are U.S. Special Operations Forces. And they have been around the globe. They're deployed in 147 of the world's 195 recognized nations, which is an increase of 80% since 2010. The global growth of special operation forces is a breathtaking thing to behold. And John Pilger talks about the 400 or so military bases that are, you know, really encircling and surrounding what's going on in China. And John Pilger, you're still on the line with us. Is that correct? John.
Yes.
Yes.
You're still there, you are.
Yes, there you are. I'm glad you're still there. So,
I've heard my own film too many times.
Oh, I'm aware. Yeah, we apologize for that. But it's a fantastic film. We're very happy that you were able to make it and share it with us here today. You know, I have an interesting something I'm interested in hearing about. The film is relatively new, but how is it being received so far? Particularly, what have you heard about the film regarding the Trump administration and Trump presidency and his sort of saber rattling around China?
Well, look, when you produce a film like this that really questions how U.S. power questions the origins and nature and shape of U.S. power, it's not shown in the United States. Probably those clips that you ran there is one of the very few times I would have thought that Americans have actually heard the film, certainly, or heard about it. Whereas the film was made initially for where I make most of my films, in Britain, and was shown on network television last December in Britain and in cinemas, and had a four-star reception and reviews and so on. It's currently being shown where I am in Australia, where it'll be shown on network television and in cinemas, and it'll be shown in other countries. It's actually been shown in China. It was within a day or so of it coming out in the UK. The film was subtitled in Chinese and put up on YouTube all over China. We had to take it down so that we could hopefully do some kind of deal with China. So my point is that it's being shown all over the world. But the US, which has constitutionally probably the freest press and media in the world, doesn't show this kind of film. You will see it in an independent cinema here and there, perhaps on independent cable television, and you will hear about it on KPFA. But you won't otherwise know about it because there is no free mainstream media in the United States. There are honorable exceptions to that rule, but there just isn't any. And I've, in all the documentary films I've made, many of them with the U.S. and U.S. power as a subject, they simply have either not been shown in the U.S. or have struggled to be shown. So it's very important that your listeners understand. understand that, and that this is an opportunity to see a film that looks at the United States from outside, not just from outside. It looks at it from the point of view of millions of its own citizens who are not allowed to have a free media. And I don't say that as some kind of rhetorical judgment. It's just a fact. So the reception to the film has been, I would think, extraordinary across much of the world. But so far in the United States, apart from your good selves and a few others, there hasn't been. And that really goes to the heart of what is wrong. It is why politicians can stand up and present themselves in a certain way, why power, domestic power in the U.S. can present itself in a certain way and not be properly challenged. The whole nonsense about fake news in the U.S., well, the mainstream media has been dispensing fake news for as long as I can remember.
And simply
invented this term fake news in order to attempt to discredit alternative sources, all of which aren't particularly meticulous. That's true, but they do represent in aspects of social media. And certainly in independent radio like yourself, they represent alternative sources. Discrediting other views in the land of free speech, they go side by side. And so any real discussion of Trump and what Trump represents and what he represents in relation to his predecessors, Obama and Bush and Clinton and all the rest, is really confined to alternative sources. So that's always been my experience in the United States. I think many Americans, a great many Americans, understand that.
John, your film is quite amazing. It clearly carries the theme that China is not trying to dominate the world militarily. They certainly are doing a great job of as capitalists in terms of building materials and things that are trading around the world. And but you talk about how the mythologies of China and Mao and communism, but part of the film addresses how Mao actually tried to work with the United States and bring capital development and expansion to China, but was rebuffed. I mean, he wanted to do that. And then the Chinese continued to expand and grow and produce. They moved 400 million people to the coast and are all the way from the north to Shanghai to Hong Kong, massive factories and producing material. So they're incredibly a strong capital nation and not a threat. But there was a piece in your film that I thought was really, really interesting. That was how during the Cuban Missile Crisis, our missiles in Okinawa were primed and ready not only to attack the Soviet Union, but we were going to go ahead and take out China at the same time. And surely the Chinese know that. Certainly know it from your film, but probably knew it before. And so the threat to them is clearly real. And that's something I think that we need to be very, very careful about.
Yes. I mean, hidden history, as I suggest in the film, is a key to the truth. And one of our problems in Western societies is that we've relegated history. Time magazine invented a slogan called the eternal present. That just sounds too clever. Of course, there is no eternal present. There is the past, and that influences everything. And I tell the story, and it's a story that has been on the historical record for some time,
of Mao's overtures. Mao Zedong made a number of overtures to presidents, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and I read from some of Mao's secret dispatches, which were sent to Washington, and which he says that, and I paraphrase him, that China wants to do a deal with the United States. China wants a close relationship with the United States. He was saying, in effect, look, we've got the people, you've got the expertise, let's come together and we can produce this extraordinary dynamo of a relationship. Now, this was coming from the communist leader of the world's biggest communist nation at the time. But communism has always been painted in such one-dimensional colors as a single monolith, and always as a threat. Mao's messages were not only ignored, but those who carried them, conscientious State Department people who went to China, met Mao, met his people, carried back these messages to Washington. They themselves were vilified, and several of them were drummed out and almost of the State Department and almost prosecuted during the McCarthyite hysteria. And at one point in the 1950s, there wasn't a single Chinese-speaking official in the State Department. The world's most populous nation is China, and the U.S. had not a single Chinese-speaking person. So the witch hunt had succeeded. And there is that sense of witch hunt is a constant theme throughout American politics. We see it at the moment. It's going on and on. Now it's to do with Russia, which is a complete fabrication that Russia brought Trump to power or some nonsense. If anyone believes that, they will believe fairy tales forever. But that it's that witch hunting that has denied the American people the kind of information to which they have a right and which the nation or the nation's institutions boast that they uniquely represent. The point about Mao's overtures was that they were lost opportunities that way back during the Second World War, post-Second World War in the 1950s, China and the United States could have formed an entirely mutually respecting and beneficial relationship. And it could have stopped wars, saved millions of lives of those who died in wars. It's a lesson in how societies, powerful societies, with their own interests, can understand each other and can work out some kind of relationship with each other that allows the rest of us to have the security of stability in the world.
And John Pilger?
It's astonishing. Yeah.
Yes, John Pilger. We wanted to we need to go and cut in and pitch for a bit now. We have to try to get people to see your movie. And we wanted to remind our listeners that we've been talking with filmmaker John Pilger, and we thank John greatly for his work and certainly for making his film available to our listeners at KPFA for a $100 pledge. That's The Coming War on China. So, John Pilger, thank you so much for joining us on the program. We're going to tell people more about your film, and then we're going to play another clip of it before we're finished here. But thank you so much for joining us on the Project
Center.
You're
very welcome. Always good to be on KPFA. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
Thanks. So you heard that was the voice of John Pilger, and his new film is The Coming War on China. It's a very timely and important film. It's a $100 pledge to Free Speech Radio by calling 800-439-5732. We really need to get some calls coming in. We have another clip that we would like to share with you so you can hear more from the movie, but it was fantastic to actually have the filmmaker, the one and only John Pilger, join us to talk about the film. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. Please join Gloria from Santa Maria, Chris and Ben Lohman. We have our good friend Esther, Esther and Joe in Kensington. Thanks so much. These are great, great colleagues of mine at Diablo Valley College. Thank you so much, Joe and Esther, for calling in and supporting the Project Censored Show. Thanks to Larry in Santa Cruz. Join them, 800-439-5732, kpfa.org, and we'd like to share one more brief clip from The Coming War on China.
I had arranged to see Professor Zhang Weiwei, a close aide to the late Deng Xiaoping, the man who changed China.
Deng is really extremely long-term visionary, a leader with exceedingly long-term strategic vision for his country, for his people. And China is still following that path. Yeah. Actually, this is really a tradition from China's long history. Mm-hmm. You look at even like Mao, you know, he said, we should, you know, surpass UK by which year, we should surpass United States by which year. So this tradition continues to this day. Even Xi Jinping today is also doing the same. Mm-hmm. Actually, what many Chinese have problem with Western media is these stereotypes about China. If you are, content with stereotypes, you miss so many things. You know, if BBC broadcast something, they are happy to always mention this communist dictatorship, this autocracy. No, actually, with this kind of label, you know, you cannot understand this China as it is. But if you watch BBC or CNN or read Economist and try to understand China, it will be a failure. It's impossible.
Multiple parties fight for political power and everyone voting on them as the only path to salvation to the long-suffering developing
world. This is Eric Lee, a Shanghai entrepreneur, educated in America, and typical of a new, confident, outspoken political class.
Fool me once. Now, in China, there are a lot of problems. But at the moment, the Chinese, the party state, has proven an extraordinary ability to change. I mean, I make the joke, in America, you can change political parties, but you can't change the policies. In China, you cannot change the party, but you can change policies. So in the 65 or 66 years, China's being run by one single party, yet the political changes that have taken place in China in this past 66 years have been wider and broader and greater than probably any other major country in modern memory.
So in that time, China ceased to be communist. Is that what you're saying?
Well, China is a market economy, and it's a vibrant market economy, but it is not a capitalist country. Here's why. There's no way a group of billionaires could control the Politburo, as billionaires control American policymaking. So in China, you have a vibrant market economy, but capital does not rise above political authority. Capital does not have enshrined rights. In America, capital, the interest of capital and capital itself has risen above the American nation. The political authority cannot check the power of capital. And that's why America is a capitalist country, but China is not.
Wow.
This is a pretty phenomenal analysis going on in John Pilger's latest film, The Coming War on China. And as you heard earlier in the program today when we were interviewing John Pilger, he said that, you know, the audience that probably needs to see this film the most in the United States is likely the audience that will see it the least. He said the film's being screened elsewhere around the world. It was even in China. online, and they had to try to take it down so they could try to work out a deal to actually show the film in China. But you can see the movie here, and we're making it available on the Project Censored Show. 800-439-5732 is the number to call. Join Lotta in San Francisco. Just called in support. We have 5 minutes left here, folks, and Peter Phillips and I on the Project Censored Show are offering this film for you. This is The Great John Pilger, The Coming War on China, a $100 pledge. We also have the Censored 2017 book, our newest Project Censored book that, guess what? Has stories in it about U.S.-China relations, has stories in it about U.S. military bases in 70% of the world's countries, military troops and special ops in 70% of the world's countries, I ought say. Please call in and get this book and get this fantastic documentary. 800-439-5732. Peter?
This is an analysis that's so vitally important in America today. And this is an opportunity for you to phone right now. We could have 50 people call in the next 5 minutes. We need you to call. We need you to support KPFA. We need you to support the Project Censored Show. And we need this movie, The Coming War on China by John Pilger, to be out there in the community, being shown to your family and friends and your church and wherever. And it's a vital piece of information for our democracy. And just the idea that we're questioning the billionaires. I mean, we have a government in power today that's mostly billionaires. And that should be a message to us. And this film will highlights that message and helps us to stand up to helping build a relationship with China that's non-aggressive. And we need you to call right now, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Help us wrap up this hour for the Project Censored Show, this mid-winter fun drive for Speaking Truth to Power at KPFA.
That's right, Peter. This is a fantastic film, John Pilger's The Coming War on China, and we talked a little bit about media in our interview with John, and of course, one of the films that we showed here in Berkeley for a debut in the U.S. was the War You Don't See. It became the film you didn't see, and it was really hard to get shown here, and it was censored even for some time in the United States. And John Pilger's films are seen around the world, and again, if you're not familiar with him, now's a great time. By supporting KPFA for a $100 pledge, you can see The Coming War on China by John Pilger. You can get the Project Censored 40th Anniversary Edition book for $120, both for $200, but you get to know that you're supporting Free Speech Radio. Peter Phillips and I come down from the North Bay for 6 years now, and we have a new team of people that we're working with. We have Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, some fantastic student interns, and we're really growing the show. We're on over 40 stations around the U.S., and we'd really appreciate you calling in and supporting us right now. 800-439-5732. 800-439-5732. That's the number to call. You can also pledge online. Don't forget kpfa.org, kpfa.org. You can go and find other premiums if you like. There are certainly fantastic programs all up and down the schedule here at 94.1 FM. But please call in now if you can, 800-439-5732. Extra special thanks, as ever and always, to our intrepid producer behind the scenes, Anthony Fest. You get to see and hear him, but he was on last week. He was on last week for us, Anthony Fest was, and he was doing a fantastic job on the Project Censored Show, as he always does. Thank you.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Theocracy versus Democracy. The Political Uses of Religion. Michael Parenti says that democracy can't survive under religious rule, whatever that religion may be. Parenti's warning in this archival recording is as timely and urgently expressed as it was when this speech was first given during the second term of the Reagan administration. It is easy to extend this timeless analysis to the present circumstances. This talk is also very funny. You will hear why God may be one of the founding fathers and what Woody Allen had to say about him. Here's Michael Parenti.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here today. A few years ago, I went on a yoga retreat in the Caribbean, a little island. It's an ashram where people practice yoga. I went because I like yoga. Unfortunately, the head of the whole, this yoga sect was there, a very religious man, and he gave sermons every morning, which the guests were required to attend. And every day he talked about love and the higher cosmic force of love. Every day he talked about how spiritual things were everything and material things are nothing. And then one day his yacht got loose from the pier and it began to float away. And he started to scream and said, "Get my yacht, get my yacht." And he had a yacht and he had a seaplane. And this man of love, I noticed, was filled with hate. He yelled at people. He kicked out a couple of people from the place because they raised some questions and he threatened to bring the police in. And it occurred to me that this Swami was the perfect theocrat, that what we had here was a theocracy, using the power of the state to enforce your will, countenancing no alternative opinions, and up to your ears in wealth. In a theocracy, there's no democracy. Now, religionists say that they're anti-materialist. They're against materialism. But that word materialism is a very funny one. It's subject to a number of misinterpretations. In fact, there are two real, quite different uses for the word. There's philosophical materialism, which argues, as you know, that ideas do not exist as independent forces, independent of material reality, as disembodied mystical forces. As the great materialist Karl Marx said, men sometimes get ideas in their head and they're so vivid that they then impute to these ideas an external existence of their own as some force out there. Now, the religionists, to be sure, are anti-materialist in that sense. That is, they believe in these spirits and they believe in these externalized imaginings. But there's a second use of the word materialism. And we often use it, I think, instinctively, quite correctly. We associate it with consumerism, self-interest, power, possessiveness, what I would call acquisitive materialism. And now here, most religious organizations really are very dedicated to this kind of materialism. They acquire throughout the centuries, they have acquired, and in many different cultures, in many different countries, in many different eras, the one thing all these religions have had in common, almost all of them, is that they have acquired vast properties and wealth, and they have used political power. They've used the legitimated authority of the state, the legal use of organized force and violence, which is Max Weber's definition of the state. They've used political power to advance their own material interests, to win gain for themselves, to exploit people, and in fact to maybe often win advantages over competing religious sects, because there are often fights between each other. And for centuries they've been involved in secular intrigues, in conflicts, in wars, in ways that have often violated their own religious precepts. Let me give you just one example from the thousands of examples from history that I could give you. Martin Luther. Now, we all know the Martin Luther who started the Reformation with his anti-materialist rebellion against Rome. But there's another lesser-known Luther, the other materialist kind of Luther, the apologist for the German princes, the defender of the aristocratic class rule. The Martin Luther who, in 1525, when the peasants were starving, when their land had been taken, when they couldn't even get a decent amount of firewood to heat themselves, when their children were going hungry, when the rents were crushing them, and they were desperate, and they rose up in rebellion in 1525, and they took over the cathedrals, and they took over the castles, and they formed committees, and they reorganized the use of the wealth, and they reorganized the use of the land for themselves, and they rose up with dignity. That Martin Luther got up, and this is what he said. He said, this is a blasphemy. He cursed the rebellion for turning, quote, everything upside down like the worst disaster. By the way, his own prince, Frederick the Wise, says this. Let me quote him first. He said, in many ways, the poor folk have been wronged by the rulers. Take something when a prince admits that. And now God is visiting his wrath upon us. But not Luther. Luther knew which side God was on, and God is on the side of the aristocracy. And he said, I'll quote him, is everything upside down like the worst disaster. And Martin Luther repeatedly urged, quote, everyone who can to, quote, smite, slay, and stab the peasants, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. And, of course, he quoted numerous passages from the Bible to justify his call to butchery. And the German princes didn't need too much encouragement. They slaughtered 100,000 peasants. Historians agree that that's pretty much the estimate that could stand. So this Luther, the great spokesman for the one true God of love and the Prince of Peace, was up to his neck in homicidal bloodletting in a repressive class war on the side of those who have more than they know what to do with against those who want a fair shake. Now, sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes the religionists use the state to advance their interests. That's what we mean by the religious uses of politics. And sometimes the state uses religion to legitimate its own exploits, and that's the political uses of religion. So politicians use religion, and religionists use politicians. This is not to say that nothing's changed. Indeed, there have been remarkable historical developments over the centuries. There have been remarkable victories for our forces. There's been a rollback of theocratic power, I mean, compared today to the 10th century, let's say. The diminishment of religious wars in the West, and the secularization of social life with the advent of science and with such forces as industrialization, urbanization, and modern socialism. But these advances don't come, and history doesn't work in a neat historical succession. Just when we think it's going one way, much to our dismay, it starts going another way. And also right here in America, as the previous speaker pointed out, there has been a real resurgence of this religious right. For generations, religionists have served corporate capitalism. They've preached obedience to the status quo. They've opposed workers trying to organize and form unions. They've opposed syndicalism, socialism. It was portrayed as the work of the devil. And in turn, capitalists, the big rich robber barons and the owners, were inclined to present themselves as the recipients of the deity's highly selective blessings. Let me quote one of them. John D. Rockefeller Sr., quote, I believe the power to make money is a gift of God. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money and still more money and more money and more money and more money. And to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience. So from this we may conclude that God is a financier. And so too today, social and political leaders constantly call upon God. Every president of the United States feels compelled to do this, but no president more so than Ronald Reagan. And it's a little scary. You know, it's one thing for certain right-wing evangelicals to announce that the Bible prophesies an imminent apocalypse, that we are now in the third and final stage, the third and final millennium, that the Antichrist forces from the East, as portrayed by Gorbachev in Russia, will meet destruction, Israel will convert, and Christ will return triumphant to deliver death upon the non-believers and elevate the believers up to eternal life into heaven. It's one thing to hear that from Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. It's quite something else when the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, tells us that he embraces the same mythology. Well, they say that the Russians are scared of Reagan, and I don't doubt it because so are many Americans. It's one thing when the fundamentalist Reverend Bailey Smith, then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tells a right-wing political rally that God, quote, does not hear the prayer of a Jew. God is an anti-Semite, it turns out. It's something else when the president of the United States announces that the United States is, quote, a Christian nation. And this surely must come as news to a loyal citizenry, which includes over 6 million Jews, several million Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, and millions upon millions of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and non-sectarian deists, who together probably compose a majority of our people. It's something when Reagan gets up there at his State of the Union message and says, this country and our Constitution could not have been formulated without divine guidance. So I sit there and I'm saying, so God is not only our father, he's our founding father. As a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear on this. The framers at Philadelphia left the deity very much out of it. And when Benjamin Franklin suggested that their daily sessions should open with a prayer asking for divine guidance, they voted it down. And Alexander Hamilton said, we don't need foreign aid.
This is the voice of Dr. Michael Parenti. You're listening to a rebroadcast of his talk, Theocracy versus Democracy, The Political Uses of Religion, recorded on April 12, 1987, in Denver, Colorado. That was near the end of the second term of Ronald Reagan. Prepared for rebroadcast in early 2017, because it still sounds as if it was given yesterday.
The Constitution is very clear that ours is not a Christian nation. Article 6 reads, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And by the way, that was a distinct and democratic advance for one who has a very critical view and of the Constitution, who feels it wasn't a very democratically motivated Constitution. Let's say that was a democratic victory for the people. It was even ahead of many state constitutions, which in those days banned Jews, Catholics, and non-believers from holding public office. And, of course, the most democratic victory came not with the founding fathers, but with the concession they had to make, they were forced to make because of those democratic forces, and that was the Bill of Rights. When Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, let's have a Bill of Rights, that was voted down almost unanimously. I think Massachusetts abstained. Later on, they realized their tactical error, and they realized if they wanted to get this thing ratified, and if they're going to win some kind of popular support for it, they'd better give the people something besides what they gave themselves in the Commerce Clause and all those other goodies and bills and credits and all the other stuff for themselves. They had to give the people something, and they put through a Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. We're witnessing not only the religionist use of politics, but the politician's use of religion. Take that issue of abortion. These guys don't care one way or another about abortion. As a matter of fact, they had the opposite position. A matter of fact, conservatives for years supported legal abortion because their view was that the poor had too many babies and was too many kids on welfare, so let's have abortions, get rid of those kids. That was their position for years. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he signed the most liberal abortion bill in the world. And his daughter had an abortion, didn't bother him at all. George Bush supported legal abortions. They've all changed now. They've all come over. And why they came over? Because they found political gold in that area. Because Richard Viguerie got up and said, hey, this is how we can split the Democratic Catholic vote. Hey, this is how we can win more of the Protestant fundamentalist vote. And Viguerie even said it. When Reagan appointed Sandra O'Connor, he said, is she soft on abortion? We cannot give up this issue. This issue helps us split the Democrats. I mean, it is the crassest case of political opportunism. Once more, as in Luther's day, using religion as an instrument of maintaining your power, religion as an instrument of class control. And Reaganism has brought forth not only the politically more conservative religious spokesmen, but also the theologically more reactionary ones. Those who evade all real social issues. You can watch these guys on television all day. You'd never know there was something called pollution, or acid rain, or poverty, or exploitation or unemployment or inflation or unfair tax laws, ruinous tax laws. You never get a sense of that. You never get a sense that people are desperate, fighting, trying to stay ahead of themselves, wondering how they're going to get through their old age. You never get any of that. All you know is that you're to blame, you're weak, and all you got to do is open up your heart to Jesus and it'll all be saved. It'll all be worked out. They have no attention to poverty, oppression, to militarism. What they do is focus on personal pieties, sectarian intolerance, and a kind of prudish, repressive moralism. In the face of all the things we have to struggle with today, they're targeting Playboy magazine. Their message is the same as it's been for centuries, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Don't organize and struggle for social justice and against the powers that be, against the powers that exploit you, against the powers that take the money out of your paycheck before you can even get it home. Don't fight against them. Just trust in God and God's love, and above all, keep those contributions coming in. And what a God it is they sell. We already know from reading the Bible that the Judeo-Christian God is vainglorious, sadistic, murderously partisan, vindictive. In fact, if you had a person like that, you wouldn't want to associate with him for 5 minutes, let alone worship him. You might recall that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, including all the unoffending and innocent children and infants in those cities, because he didn't like the lifestyle of certain of the citizens and what they were doing. He took great satisfaction when his Israelites acted like imperialists and massacred. Read the Book of Kings where he says, and the Israelites slew 20,000. When the first time I read that, I was astonished. I said, my God. And God was pleased. And the Israelites went out and they slew 35,000 and killed them all. And God was happy. I said, my God, what a God. Not my God. And I'm saying to myself, but this God is Caligula. This God is one of the... or some other homicidal mad despot. We also know that God is a terrorist and an extortionist. Listen to Oral Roberts, who says that God's going to zap me unless they come up with 8 million smackers by the end of March. There's the Baptist minister Everett Sullivan. Now this guy ran in the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. 4 candidates, he came in 4th. And a woman won. So what did Sullivan says? He says, this was a curse. Evidence of God's curse. Quotes from the Bible, the good book, right? The good book, Jeremiah. Jeremiah plainly tells us that when the people of a nation are willing to accept the leadership of a woman, it is a sure sign of God's curse, unquote. Talk about a sore loser, huh? Well, we always knew God was a male supremacist, too. Now, the point I want to make here is less a theological one than a political one. It's that the crude religionism of the right demonstrates not only the obviously anthropomorphic origin of the God image, but also the exploitative, opportunistic use of religion as an instrument of oppression, as an instrument of material acquisition, as an instrument of political power and political privilege. It is not merely that the God hucksters are silly and superstitious, rather they are keenly self-interested, manipulative, and politically powerful. Not only do the religionists preach pie in the sky by and by, but they live high off the hog here and now. While preaching otherworldliness to their followers, they're up to their ears in the crassest pursuits of wealth, power, class interests, and if we can believe what's happening to Jimmy Baker, other crass pursuits. They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves. However, as I say, although history moves in fitful and often uncertain steps, the general thrust has really been forward. Important democratic victories have been won. Theocratic forces still menace us. They enjoy unexpected resurgence, but they no longer rule over the Western world the way they once did. Also today, in about a third of the world, in existing socialist countries, in communist countries, the oppressive, horrible, totalitarian Congress countries, theocracy has been thoroughly vanquished, which is not to say that religion is prohibited. Every traveler who's gone there, including Billy Graham, says that people are free to practice their religions. And there's freedom for synagogues, churches, for Baptists, Jews, Church of Christ, Roman Catholic denominations. The misrepresentation in the West on this issue, and it's constant that religion isn't free in the USSR or other communist countries, It's, again, another political use of the religious issue, because for the religionist, communism is a threat, not only because atheism is not tolerated, but because atheism has an official status as a creed. And this is what the religionists cannot forgive. It's kind of ironic, you know. In evil totalitarian Russia, atheism has achieved a pluralistic safeguard superior to what is found in our own supposedly democratic pluralistic society. And there's more open, unharassed freedom of belief in communist countries for religious believers than there is for atheists in the USA. We can also witness a new revolutionary development within the ranks of religion itself, especially in Latin America, with liberation theology. And the threat of liberation theology is that it doesn't diminish man to God, but puts him as the center of God's concern, and it also speaks for the interests of a different social class from the one that religionists usually represent. Liberation theology is not for theocracy, but against it. It's not for what the French call le prêtre du double menton, the priest of the double chin. It's for the hungry and the immiserated. To the extent that liberation theology has this democratic social content, it represents an historically progressive development, even if we can still disagree with them theologically about things. Instead of conjuring up a god who is the object of pietistic idolatry and interior imaginings, liberation theology sees God as manifest in social justice, in economic betterment for all the people, a more decent life here on earth, so that the lowliest among us shall be among the best, and the parasitic, the exploitative, the oppressors, the plutocrats, the dictators shall be cast aside. That's really a subversive religion. That's really getting close to what Christianity really is supposed to be about. And also in the USA, there's a Christian left that's developed, it's emerged, which sides with the poor, with the political refugees from fascism and the peace movement, and which does not support the kind of Reagan restrictions, the kind of breaking down of church and state walls, and the kind of restrictions on other people's creeds. So for some believers, at least, it seems that God is not a jingoist or a militarist or a financier, but he's a pacifist and a progressive and maybe even a revolutionary. So it becomes clear that God is about as good as the people who believe in him, which is understandably so, since he is made in their image. My own view on God is the one that's offered by the great American theologian Woody Allen, who once said that maybe God does exist, but he's an underachiever. Imagine being omnipotent and producing this, right? Tornadoes, plagues, fascists, all these things. Well, what is to be done? 3 short points, then I'll sign off. The immediate goals that we might consider worth struggling for. First, we have to get the religionists off welfare. Make the rich churches and the multimillionaire TV evangelists pay a fair share of taxes on their immense holdings and investments. We have to get their hands, their loving, beseeching hands, we have to get those hands out of our pockets. Stop this theocratic rule where the state forces us to subsidize them in their propagandizing of their faith, which is a violation of our beliefs and a violation of the Constitution that is using the state in that way. Not propagating their faith, they can do that. Second, free thinkers, liberation theologists, atheists, agnostics, etc., should have equal time on television. I just wrote a book called Inventing Reality, which deals with the way that political ideas and information are controlled by the news media, but the same thing could be said about creed. Alternative views are systematically shut out. Dissident opinions get no hearing. I mean, occasionally a local radio show. Madeline Murray O'Hare will be interviewed or someone else like that. But for the most part, you could just see that it's not a non-secular TV. Dissident opinions get no hearing. There's no free market of ideas. Third, we must roll back Reaganism and its war against the First Amendment and its war against the separation of church and state and against our freedom and our beliefs. And that we can... And I think the Reaganites have been weakened by the Iran-Contra scandal, and so there are new opportunities for us to fight back. not just to complain, but to fight back, and not to feel that they're all so powerful and they're so dangerous. Not, they're dangerous, it's true, but you have to do what the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci once said, and what Madeleine Murray O'Hare practiced, even though I bet she didn't read Gramsci on this point. He said, you must have a pessimism of the mind, be able to see the worst, the dangers, and an optimism of the will to fight back and know that there are victories that we could win, and more of them will be ours. Even though some of us may not realize it, we are part of very much of a long historical struggle. We are involved in making history, a little, just a little bit of it. Maybe a paragraph was made right out there today. To those who would make the world safe for hypocrisy, we say that our country needs something more than freedom of religion. We need freedom of belief, including the freedom not to believe in spirits and demons without putting our jobs and civil liberties at risk. Our historic task is not to vanquish religion, but to vanquish theocracy, I think, and with it, all the abuses and privileges upon which it feeds. This, ladies and gentlemen, would be, and it will be, a great victory for humanity and for democracy. Thank you.
That was an archival speech by Michael Parenti on Theocracy versus Democracy, The Political Uses of Religion. He was recorded in Denver, Colorado on April 12, 1987, at the American Atheist National Convention. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York City and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti is an internationally known writer and lecturer. He's the author of 23 books. Please find a pen to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order the extended version of this speech, a 45-minute CD of Michael Parenti on the political uses of religion. This program is also available as film on DVD. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. For links to Michael Parenti's website and more information, TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD or DVD order keeps this program on the air. You can find a free download of the 29-minute version of this talk on TUC Radio's website or call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the reorientation of the economy in southern BC from production and manufacture to this finance capitalism and an over-reliance on real estate as a major engine of urban economies, that's what produces a consumer economy that's hostile to working class people, to working class people who are no longer as necessary as drivers of the economy here locally as they had been 30 or 40 years ago. So that's why our communities are being thrown under the bus of globalization and neoliberalism.
That's the voice of longtime housing activist Ivan Drury. In this week's show, we speak to Ivan in his fight to protect working class affordable housing in the Metrotown area against gentrification. This is a struggle that is unfolding all across North America. We speak about why this is happening and what we can do to fight back to protect affordable housing for average people. So stay tuned. My name is Stuart Richardson, and you're listening to Latin Waves. On this week's show, we're going to examine a phenomenon that's been happening all over North America, especially in the large cities. It appears that people have lost faith in the stock market, so many wealthy individuals are speculating on real estate, and housing has become just another commodity. This creates a situation where there's many winners, but there's many more losers who are just trying to make a house a home and find some housing in their region. On the line to talk about this is Ivan Drury. He's a longtime BC housing advocate, and we're going to talk about a specific area in Burnaby called Metrotown where this has really been accelerated. Welcome to the show, Ivan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, can you explain the Burnaby Metrotown area and what the scope of what's been happening there the last 2, 3, 4 years?
Well, Metrotown is historically the working class and migrant neighborhood on the outskirts of Vancouver. It's in the first suburb around the perimeter of Vancouver in Burnaby, and it's the place in the neighborhood in Burnaby that has the highest density of rental apartments, and the highest density of renters and not owners. More than 70% of the residents of Metrotown from the last census were recorded as renters. It's also the lowest income community in Burnaby, with more than 50% of the people in the community being considered somewhat on the edge of homelessness because they're paying between 30 to 50% of their incomes towards rent. It also has the highest density of languages other than English spoken in the home of any community in the Lower Mainland. And it tends to be historically have been the community where when people arrive new to Vancouver or to Canada, it's the place where they tended to land. So in the past, refugee settlement agencies put a great number of their clients in the apartments in the Metrotown area, and new immigrants, working class immigrants, would settle in the apartments in that area as well. This has been shifting dramatically in the last 5 years, and there's been an escalating gentrification and displacement of these working class and racialized communities in the last couple of years. These income demographics have changed significantly. Refugee settlement agencies now report that they have practically no clients at all in that area. There's an increasing instability and of the working class character of Metrotown. The reason for that is that the city council has targeted the mass of low-rise rental apartments that were built in the 60s and 70s that are referred to by housing experts as a kind of low-end of market purpose-built rental stock. They've been targeting those for redevelopment into high-rise condos. They've been doing this for the last 3 years at a fairly high rate by rezoning those buildings one at a time. And the Fraser Institute and Vancouver Magazine recognize Burnaby as the most development-friendly municipality in the Lower Mainland and one of the most development-friendly in all of Canada, because they ask practically nothing of those developers when they build these condo developments. They don't ask them to put any rental housing or social housing into those new projects, and they basically provide no amenities for the people who are being pushed out by the demolition of the old buildings. So in the last couple of years, we've lost now close to 800 units of low end of market rental housing to these site by site demolition projects, which our campaign has dubbed demovictions, because they are mass evictions for the purpose of demolition and redevelopment for high end condos.
Now, Ivan, you're quite right. When I moved here many years ago from Ontario, my young family, we were very low income, and we either could live in South Burnaby or New West. We luckily found a one-bedroom for four of us living in New Westminster, and God knows what we would have done if we didn't have that place available. Now, let's touch on a couple things. First of all, isn't there any protections, say, for the Landlord Tenancy Act or anything for someone who signed a lease in one of these buildings for their families? Isn't there some kind of built-in protections for these people?
Tenants have protections against arbitrary evictions under the BC Residential Tenancy Act. But as is the case with our cluster of rights in a liberal democracy, like Canada's, the rights of property owners trump the rights of individual working class people or renters. So we have some rights as renters in our buildings, but if the property owner decides to change the use of their building from a tenanted building that they rent into something else, like if the owner wants to take the unit over, or if they want to destroy that unit in order to redevelop it as a different form, then they have that basically unchallengeable right through the in the residential tenancy system. So it's called evictions for landlord use. Is something that's protected by the RTA in British Columbia. So if the level of government that would be able to slow mass evictions for demolition, which is a form of landlord use, the level of government is not the province and the Residential Tenancy Act. It's the city governments. In most cases, they can't stop landlords from demolishing the buildings they own and building again within the zoning that's already the set zoning for the area. But they can provide disincentives for those kinds of demolitions by refusing to grant rezoning applications for higher buildings or greater densities. But the city of Burnaby is doing the opposite. Rather than disincentivizing development, they're doing everything they can to incentivize developers to buy up these buildings with the purpose of demolishing them. So the effect is they're doing that by saying, basically, you can, if you submit a rezoning application, in practice, they've been giving them whatever they want. They can go from 3 stories to 30 stories or 40 stories with very little of a payout towards the community. The effect of that has been that the BC Assessment Corporation that assesses the value of properties and then determines what levels of taxes property owners will pay, they're anticipating that for this year, all of the buildings in the Metrotown area, which is there's about 3,000 units of rental housing in that area at this point. All of those buildings, they're anticipating to have an increase in value of the land by 3 times. And they're also anticipating a devaluing of the built structures on those lands by 90%. And this is the case for almost all of the buildings in the area that is being targeted for redevelopment by Burnaby. It means that the market is anticipating the destruction of all of those units into rubble. And a massive increase in value of the land, which can be done by the stroke of a pen at council level by rezoning that land to take on higher density, higher towers.
Let's take it up to the next level. The city government you mentioned is just signing off in these applications. You would think that the city of Burnaby and Mayor Corrigan were some rabid free market right-wingers, but he calls himself a socialist, and he supports many progressive causes, and he's a known supporter of the NDP. What has been the response? Has there been any positive feedback from the mayor that this policy could change or may change, or there's some compromise?
Well, we've been organizing the campaign against the demoviction of Metrotown for the last 2 years, and we've received nothing but derision from Mayor Corrigan. Corrigan, I think, is a typical post-social democrat politician, like Tony Blair in Britain, or like Zuma in South Africa. Corrigan is cynically posturing as a social democrat on a kind of historic labor position, but his entire orientation for the development of Burnaby is about market forces. He refuses provincial money to put a homeless shelter in Burnaby. And he makes a little bit of noise about some housing, some social housing that they've built, but really it's entirely smoke and mirrors. And they've done nothing to replace the units that are there. When residents who've been evicted from these buildings for demolition have spoken out in the media, or we've taken hundreds of people to Burnaby Council chambers to speak against rezoning applications, Corrigan says things like, this is prime real estate and it's not for the likes of a common worker. People have to be able to afford to live near SkyTrains, which is a sort of attitude that's at odds with how planners consider what should be developed around transit corridors. Planners propose that housing developments that are for working class people who don't have vehicles and who need to commute for their jobs, that sort of housing should be concentrated on transit corridors. He's building the sorts of housing that is not transit consumers, not transit users who are mm-hmm. going to be living there. It's going to be people who have expensive cars in their basements. Now, rather than listen to the appeals of people who are being affected by these mass rezoning policies, or these site-by-site rezoning policies, and rather than pay attention to the research that have come out of the grassroots communities, like we did a social impact study last year where we interviewed people on a block that was every single building on the square block was set to be demolished. Mm. And we went and did door knocking and talked to everybody in there. We discovered that about a quarter of those being evicted are being pushed into forms of homelessness by these evictions. All of the long-term residents, there's a lot of seniors who've been in these buildings for 20 or 30 years, whose rents are depressed because there are some controls over rent increases on a single tenancy. So they're paying, some people are paying $500 or $600 for one bedroom. And when they leave, they're moving into a market where the rents are more like $1,000 or $1,200 for a similar unit. So they really have no options. But faced with these things, rather than slow the demolition process and try to find ways to stabilize life for those folks, Corrigan's answer has been to put forward a Metrotown rezoning plan, to have a development plan update for the whole area that will, in a blanket sense, change the zoning for the whole region, affecting all 3,000 units of affordable low into market housing and replacing it all with condos. So that plan is set to be voted on by council this spring and has become focus of what we're trying to stop.
Just to give our listeners some perspective, I have a friend who lives in East Van and he's got a good job. He's educated. His partner works at UBC and they're both doing really well. And they wanted to move closer to UBC and they would go to an apartment and there'd be 12 or 13 couples looking at the same unit and there would be bidding wars on rentals. So let's say the place was $1,200, someone would pipe up and say, hey, I'll give you 15, I'll give you 17. Mm-hmm. So we're having bidding wars on available units. Now, here's something I want to touch on before we get into the actual process of how we're going to resist this. What happens to these people? Where do they go? You mentioned some are homeless, they may be hidden homeless, but talk about the pressures that this puts on the rest of what's available in the region and how this has that kind of ripple effect.
Well, this is the main thing that we want to focus on when we discuss the Metrotown plan that Corrigan's proposing. Is that destroying 3,000 units of housing in the Metrotown area of Burnaby is not just a Burnaby issue. The rental stock in the Fraser Valley, the whole of the Vancouver region, is strained, has historically low vacancy rates. That's why we're seeing these kinds of bidding wars. Like some of the people, we were just organizing a rally 2 days ago for people who are in a building who the developer is denying them the compensation that they're supposed to receive under Burnaby's bylaws, and Burnaby's saying they won't support these residents. But some of those folks in there said that they moved into this building knowing it would be demolished. They moved in like 8 months ago, being told that they would have a couple of years before it'd be demolished, but they received an eviction notice after only 4 months. But for a building that was set to be demolished, there was bidding wars. People were lining up to move into a unit for just whatever months they could squeeze out of it, because there's just a horrible absence of just a lack of units for people to move into. So the people moving out of buildings that are being demolished now are moving into buildings nearby in the same area, knowing that this entire area is set to be demolished and that they're going to have to move again in the next couple of years. there's an elderly woman, a woman who's 56 years old, who lives in this building with her daughter, who's in her early 20s and is a full-time student, who cares for her mother, who has disabilities. They were evicted from Coquitlam, from a building in Coquitlam that was getting demolished last year, and the development company moved them into another building they managed in the Metrotown area. And then 8 months ago, they were evicted from that building for a demolition into this building, mm-hmm. and now this building is being demolished, and they're being forced to move again. So this mother and daughter have moved. Now, this will be the third time that they've been demo-evicted in 2 years. The kind of psychological impact of this kind of reality is that one of constant stress. Even if people don't live in a building that's under a rezoning process, they're all just looking at their watches and waiting for it to be their turn. There are some people who can move around and find a new place, but it comes down to race and class questions about how you pass and how you can present yourself as a good tenant to a prospective landlord. The landlords can really choose from a litany of people. And so this means that those who are most vulnerable are those who are also experience racism from landlords, who don't have English as a first language, and the landlords will discriminate against for linguistic reasons or take advantage of because they can't read contracts or aren't familiar with tenancy law in BC. People who the landlord might profile as low income or as not having a stable income, people who are on pensions or welfare or disability, these folks really cannot find apartments in these contexts. They're the ones who are moving into these places that are set to be demolished as a temporary housing. And this is a broader condition that we're facing in this neoliberal society in Western Canada, that we have temporary jobs, temporary housing, and our lives, unfortunately, are not temporary. We have to make a go of things for a long time to come. And so we have to fight these things out. And that's where we're presented with a real challenge.
I know that MP, the federal MP, is Kennedy Stewart. That's his riding. I know he said some things about housing, and I know the provincial NDP are coming up for election in May. Any hints that there's some allies in the upcoming election? Has the NDP really said anything in their platform about housing? Is there any kind of glimmer of hope in that direction?
This has been a very frustrating point about this particular campaign. Is that Mayor Corrigan's party is the Burnaby Citizens Association, the BCA. And to be a member of the BCA, you have to be a member of the NDP. It's like a municipal branch of the NDP. And the NDP has really rallied around Corrigan and refused to critique him publicly. We have the sense that there are some differences in the party about how he's proceeding with this process, but that those differences haven't boiled over into public critique. And so Kennedy Stewart, David Eby, the provincial and federal MPs and MLAs for the NDP in this area, and like every MLA in Burnaby is NDP. So there's no shortage of those who could have spoken out or put on some pressure and said, like, this isn't acceptable. None of them have. Eby spoke out once just over a year ago when he was in Ottawa and then was silent ever after. It just feels like he was silenced by the party. So the NDP rallying around Corrigan here indicates a bigger problem about how the party is going to conduct itself in the coming BC election. In the last election, they tried to play themselves as close to the center as possible, and they were completely outflanked by the BC Liberals. And rather than learn from that and orient themselves towards a sense of resistance against politics of austerity and neoliberal financial capitalism, they seem to be doing the same thing again, adopting some kinds of law and order stances, being reasonable about market investment. Most of what they've said about housing has been about foreign investment being crowding out professional prospective home buyers locally in BC, in southern British Columbia. They haven't said anything specific about the crisis that's really affecting us here, which is that, as a recent report said, there's 4,000 homeless people in Metro Vancouver. More than 70 homeless camps exist around the city, and there were 3 independent reports authored last year that blamed the loss of purpose-built rental stock as a direct contributor towards that increasing homelessness. The NDP's inaction on stopping that at the municipal level here in Burnaby, which they could completely do, is an indicator of their refusal to stand up to free market capitalism and to this austerity and neoliberal trend. we see every indication that they're going to be nothing but a light form of the BC Liberals in the coming election. Not only is that disappointing in a kind of a historical political arc, but it's a betrayal of the really severe needs of really thousands, tens of thousands of people in this province.
Now let's talk about the market economy, the neoliberal capital economy and housing market in BC, because our premier came on a few months ago and she said she's going to make it better by imposing a 15% tax on foreign buyers, which I think fundamentally is not going to do much. If you push down the price slightly, then you just justify the tax. So can we regulate a housing market? What are some of the solutions to this problem then that you're advocating for?
Well, I think we need to think about the housing market here within a framework of global capitalism and Canadian imperialism. And this is the diversion that is happening for Christy Clark and the BC Liberals and also the BC NDP is to blame foreign buyers, blame consumers for a production problem. And so the reorientation of the economy in southern BC from production and manufacture to this finance capitalism and an over-reliance on real estate as a major engine of urban economies. That's what produces a consumer economy that's hostile to working class people, to working class people who are no longer as necessary as drivers of the economy here locally as they had been 30 or 40 years ago. So that's why our communities are being thrown under the bus of globalization and neoliberalism. And the solution to that problem is about admitting that the housing market does not have space for working class people. Our fight should not be to try to get a toehold in home ownership. Home ownership has always been about making claims over unceded indigenous territory for settlers to get the land and housing that they couldn't afford back in Europe. And we need to reject that whole paradigm and instead say that we need to have social housing or universal housing, non-market housing as a condition of being a person on this land. It can be a model of redistribution of capitalist wealth that is stolen from us, and also a redistribution of indigenous lands, because a redistribution of the wealth stolen from indigenous people back to indigenous people, because those people are suffering more than anyone else demographically in this housing crisis. So our model is not to look at the solutions in terms of adjusting the profile of homeowners, or looking for what is basically a housing tariff to protect local investors against the might of foreign investors. These are not issues for working class people. These are not issues for indigenous people. Our justice can be taken by redistributing wealth downwards and supporting lower income people to be able to survive here so that we can carry on fights for justice in more broader and more transformative ways than just trying to get a roof over our heads.
Absolutely. And many years ago, I was lucky enough to get a place in a cooperative housing, and they tied it to your income. So if your income increased, your rent would slightly increase, but never exceeding a certain amount of your income. And it's surprising when people have good housing, all the other social health factors increase very quickly. And I remember 70% of the people in the co-op were paying the regular amount because all of their lifestyle and their health indicators increased. Now, Ivan, I just wanted to find out how our listeners can get some more information or support your efforts and find out more of what's going on there, if not just to help you, but to also look into what you're doing so they can do similar things in their communities.
Well, we'd also love to be in touch more with people who are engaged in struggles like these in other cities around North America and the world. One of our weaknesses is that over the last 30 years, our communities have become increasingly isolated into neighborhoods or just single cities. And that's created kind of a localism where we are obsessed about this one space. And we've lost sight of the interconnectedness of our struggles globally, particularly on questions like housing. So the organization that I organize with is called Alliance Against Displacement. And we're part of organizing this campaign in Burnaby, which is the Stop Demo Evictions campaign, Burnaby. But our website is stopdisplacement.ca. I also work on a social movement publication that broadcasts the struggles and analysis of communities here, mostly in British Columbia. It's called the Volcano Newspaper. And we have a weekly newsletter as well as a quarterly print publication. And our website is thevolcano.org.
That's amazing. And I was just reading some of the high quality articles on that website just before I called you up. And I do encourage people can submit things to you then and contact you for the site.
Absolutely. Particularly about struggles in other places. It would be great to publish some things that enter us into discussions beyond this thing, this often depressing world immediately around us.
Thank you so much, Ivan, for the work you do and spending a few moments with you. Any final thoughts before I let you go?
No, I think you've got it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ivan. We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.